The hour of 12:30 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We're not quite there yet. But what we will do, we'll be taking up at this point House File 1598. If Representative Drazkowski could please join us. What we'll be looking at here is an introduction of the bill from the author. He does have an author's amendment that we are not able to act upon quite yet. As soon as we have the quorum here, we will get the bill in the shape that the author would like. And the motion would be then from Representative Drazkowski to move the bill as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. So with that, members, Representative Drazkowski, if you could please present your bill in the order that as it would be amended, is what we'd like to do, even though it's not technically amended or technically before us yet. So if you could please present your bill, and then be my intention to take your witnesses, Representative Drazkowski, folks that are supporting the bill, then we'll go to folks that may have some concerns on the bill, and then members will go till about 2:15 or so this afternoon, then we'll be coming back at 6:30, and I realize that a lot of people have about four or five places to be at all at the same time, but we'll do the best we can. So, Representative Drazkowski, if you could please present your bill, sir, as it will be amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair and members, House File 1598 is a proposal to, or a bill to put a proposal to the people of Minnesota to, which would amend the state constitution by requiring of the legislature before that we could in the future have the ability to raise taxes on the people of Minnesota, that it would require a 60% or three-fifths vote of this legislature, which translates into 81 votes of the Minnesota House. Going through the bill, members, really the contents begin on line 1.9, where it talks about the types of taxes that it would apply to. It would apply to the income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes, which are defined later in the bill. The definition of what a property tax increase, members, is included on 1.16 and 1.17.
Excuse me, Representative Drazkowski. We now officially have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Crawford moves the minutes of April 27th. Any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Crawford. Now we will go to Representative Drazkowski moves House File 1598. It would be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. We have an amendment. Usually in this committee we like to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Representative Drazkowski moves the H159882 amendment. Any discussion on that? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 1598 as amended. If you could please continue your description of the bill. Then, members, we will go to proponents of the bill, then folks that have concerns. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at lines 1.16 and 1.17, which in the order of the bill, members, because of the amendment, will be kind of shifted up because there was a portion in the middle that the amendment actually moved to the bottom of page 1 on the bill. Just so things were in better order, and there was also some restating of that middle part in 1.11 through 1.15 so that we brought more clarity to that, and that's what 1.7 and 1 through 1.10 on the amendment did. But the definition of what a property tax increase is included, as I mentioned, on lines 1.16 to 1.17, the bill also would provide that it would require the same three-fifths vote of the legislature in order to pass a new tax and create a new tax of statewide applicability. Additionally, that language I talked about, which is really the middle of the amendment, is a revenue neutrality statement or revenue neutrality piece that says basically you would still be able to, as a legislature, only require a majority vote to raise taxes if it was met with an equal or greater than equal decrease in taxes. So that's what that section says. And then members, the bottom, we did actually provide some technical changes to the submission to voters language, which is on the amendment on 1.11 through 1.13, is a language that would appear on the ballot that people would respond to as they vote on this amendment. Members, that is a summary of the bill. Bills like this, constitutional amendments like this, have been placed into the constitutions in 15 different states and offered to an extent statutorily in another state. And those, I think there's a handout that came around that outlined those. Those vary from a 3/5 majority as is being proposed in this amendment, with actually the bulk of those states being in the 2/3 majority, which would be a stronger majority required, and about 3 states at a 3/4 majority. Members, this bill, again, it would send this language to the voters for their entertainment in considering the need to amend the state constitution. It would place it in Article 4 of the state constitution, right after the 2/3 vote limitation by the legislature to pass a general banking law. It's similar to the 3/5 majority that's required now for us to pass a bonding bill. It's also similar in nature, as it is in other states, to the 2/3 veto override that's required to override a governor's veto. And there was a similar bill passed in 1999 through the House, and from what I read, it received 81 votes in order to pass, which is somewhat ironic or coincidental. So that's really what I have, members, at this point. Be willing to entertain questions, or maybe, Mr. Chair, you'd like to hear from some of the testifiers. The motivation for the bill, Mr. Chair, as I have been out over the last year or more, I have heard very clear and loudly from people that we need to rein in the spending of state government that has grown in the state of Minnesota at a rate of, since 1960, of 500% after adjusted for inflation and population growth. Mr. Chair, this amendment, if the voters are interested in it, would do that.
Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. Before we get it, you can bring your first testifier up that would like to testify on behalf of the bill, in support of the bill. And while Mr. Krinke's coming down, I'd like to introduce to the committee the new tax page, Karen Rudin. If you just kind of wave. Yep. Welcome to the tax committee. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Welcome, committee members. My name is Phil Krinke, president of the Taxpayers League of Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you for having me today and allowing me to speak briefly about this issue. First and foremost, I brought along my copy of the Constitution of the state of Minnesota, and on the summary that you all received, it says that 3/5 majority is required to authorize state debt. What it doesn't say is in the preceding section 4 of the state constitution that public debt includes any obligation payable directly in whole or in part from statewide application of any, basically of any tax. So essentially, in a broad definition, the 3/5 vote for raising taxes already exists in the state constitution, and I'm sure that Mr. Michael can explain this much better than I can, but the point is that, as I said, in a broad definition, it's already there, so putting this issue to the voters in 2012, I think, would be a good idea as a clarification as to what Section 4 of the Constitution already says with regard to state debt, because obviously what this means, and for all intents and purposes, if the state cannot pay their debt on the bonds, that a statewide tax would be implemented in order to pay the debt. And just as a side note, that's one of the fastest growing areas of the state budget is the state debt. So with that Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Krenke? Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and former Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Since it's your contention, Mr. Krenke, that the three-fifths requirement is already essentially, for passage of taxes, already essentially in the Constitution, it sounds like a question of interpretation from your perspective. Has the Taxpayers League ever gone to court to sue, arguing that taxes that the Hennepin County tax that you and I opposed together is unconstitutional?
Representative Krenke.
Hey, you.
That's hey, you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, the simple answer is no. As someone who has litigated against two previous governors without success, my record in court isn't very good, so I haven't been really willing. And again, I think the key point is, I've said in a very broad definition, as I said, the three-fifths majority is already there. I think, again, it would be a good idea to put the question before the voters to see how they react to this idea in terms of really clarification of what is currently in the Constitution.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Krenke, you know, you talked about the bonding requirements, and I know that one of the things that has helped us in terms of making affordable bonding things has been our AAA credit rating and our ability to convince bond rating companies that we have a good revenue base that will pay back those bonds. And my understanding is that this may actually have some chilling effect with the bond rating companies in terms of feeling like the state would have the ability to raise its revenues should disasters occur, should circumstances change, and jeopardize their ability to repay that. And I think that's been an issue raised in some of the states that have approved this. Have you looked at that issue?
Mr. Krenke?
Well, I also had the privilege of chairing the Capital Investment Committee, and the issue of how bond houses make their determinations and on what basis has been a mystery to me. And I think I don't believe there's any direct correlation between, again, how they make their determination as to what the credit rating is and what some of the tax policies are within the state. Again, what this provision already in the Constitution says, there would be an automatic tax increase, as I understand it, even if the legislature did not approve one. Again, as I said, interpretation of what the Constitution says.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. In a previous life, I actually did work with local governments on developing debt policies and actually interviewed the people at Moody's and Standards and Poor's who actually do the bond rating to see what they look at. And they were pretty firm at that point in time that they really look at your revenue base, your whether or not you had a five-year projection of revenues and expenditures, and that it looked like you were thoughtfully not only just dealing with your budget for today but long-term. That those were really factors that they weighed in making that. It wasn't just whether or not you got a clean bill of health from an auditor who said you kept the books straight. It was actually about planning and having the revenues to deal with unusual circumstances, both your reserves, both for cash and for unexpected opportunities. And as we all know, we have drained down our reserves to the point that they don't exist. And I suspect that if this were to pass, we wouldn't have the ability to refill that well. Or at least it would be more difficult. We'd have to cut other things.
Mr. Krenke?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, I think it's really quite simple. It goes to something I think that's been mentioned by a number of people during these very difficult economic times, and that is called living within your means. I think that's what the bond council looks for, is do you have the ability to pay the debt that you are incurring? Same thing as when you go to apply for a mortgage. The underwriters look at your income. Do you have the ability to repay or the loan on the house that you're buying? So again, it's prudent fiscal management and a key eye on the fiduciary responsibility that each of you have.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a final comment on that, and that is it's very different than a mortgage. A mortgage, you have a fixed payment, you have an agreed-upon price. You know, that is the obligation of the person who's buying that house, is to pay whatever the principal is of the loan over the life of that mortgage. Where in providing government services, we have to step up. If we have a period of time at some point in the future, and this is a constitutional amendment, so it should be there for the next 100 years, like after World War II when we had a huge baby boom and a huge demand in increased numbers of students going into schools. You couldn't build schools fast enough at that point. The state contribution, you know, had to rise in recognition of our responsibility under the Constitution for education. And so it's not, we have to be able to have the flexibility to respond to changing obligations. It's not, I don't think, analogous at all to a mortgage. I think a capital bonding request is definitely more similar to a mortgage. But we're talking about the funds for our basic obligations to serve the children, to operate the prisons, to deal with the kinds of obligations that are in our operating budget. So I do think that we need to look at it more in terms of its potential long-term impact on the state's ability to ride the waves of changes in demographics, changes in federal support, changes in our tax base because of a depression. The state has to be able to ride those waves and still maintain its constitutional obligations in terms of services. So I think it's a little more complicated than a capital budget, but I appreciate your time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a comment, and I'd like Mr. Grinke to respond. But I also happen to have had, I made a notation, changing demographics, and I had put down the baby boomers in World War II. I happened to predate the baby boomers by a little bit, but my parents, after World War II, my dad was a vet. They had three children right after the war. And we lived in a suburban community that was building one classroom a week, was what was happening with the baby boomers. And that was a huge drain on the communities and on the state. But they met those obligations. They built the buildings. When I was in high school, by the way, to help adjust for that, I went to school half days. What they did was my classmates and I started at 7 a.m. and we got out at noon, and then they brought in the junior high from noon until like 5 or 6 p.m. Just to kind of get through that period while they were in that rapid growth. But that was happening across the state with the baby boomers. Now, just as a follow-up to what Representative Loeffler was saying, those baby boomers are now moving into the classification of senior citizen. And my question Mr. Krinke, let's take health care, nursing homes, hospitals. We know that those demands are going to increase as the baby boomers reach retirement age. And how, under your proposal, would the state be able to respond to the needs of our hospitals and nursing homes?
Mr. Krinke.
And other related services that older citizens will be in need of.
Mr. Krinke.
The Chair Davids, Representative Carlson. I think that, again, we're going a little bit beyond the bounds of what the proposal in front of the committee says. But in my tenure in the legislature, I did not see a great burden or a great difficulty in passing general obligation debt for the state of Minnesota, which, as we know, requires a three-fifths vote. So I think what Representative Druskowski is putting to the people of the state of Minnesota, or wants to put to the people of Minnesota, if a counter to, if you're willing to, if it takes three-fifths majority to pass a debt, then you have to pay for the debt somehow. So why wouldn't there be a corresponding three-fifths vote in order to raise taxes to pay the debt? I think we all know that it's far easier to spend money than it is necessarily to raise the money required to meet those obligations, exactly what you're talking about. So the process seems to balance. In other words, before we go off and incur the debt, then we should have a corresponding methodology in order to raise the taxes to pay the debt. I've seen many times, as I think any member around the table has, where somebody's willing to vote for a spending bill but isn't willing to vote for a tax bill in order to fund the spending that they want to tell their constituents that they're going to provide. So, again, this is, in my view, what would be a balancing amendment, saying, okay, folks, you want to go out and incur the debt, you want to provide those services, whether it's schools or whether it's health care, whether it's public safety, well, then there needs to be a corresponding tax increase or revenue in order to balance the spending. So, again, this is just a quid pro quo, a balance to say, you want to spend the money, we have to raise the money in order to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Carlson.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to Representative Carlson. One of the things that this would help is it would help us as a legislature not, instead of focusing simply at times on taxation as a first response to a budget situation, it would require us, it would force us to bring about a more thorough analysis of the budget situation and of the options that we have and exhaust those many times before going to tax increases. This would require that tax increases would require many times elements of both parties. It would prohibit situations where small majorities would easily increase taxes and require more widespread support for the final decision if that is a decision to be made.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure that Mr. Krenke really answered the question that I was asking, because he gave a very narrow response and a very narrow bit of testimony. It almost sounded as though he was talking only about a bonding bill, and we all know that if we read the bill, it goes far beyond that. And what I was talking about, and maybe I led you a bit astray when I was talking about building a classroom a week, because you had to put a teacher in that classroom, and that's coming out of the general fund, and that took revenue. And when I talk about the needs of older citizens, when that same group of baby boomers now are retiring, and we all know that that's when you have the greatest need in the area of health care and other services. That's why I was referencing nursing homes and hospitals and other programs that help seniors with their health care needs. There's going to be a huge increase, and we're just on the crest of that right now. And in my view, the amendment that is before us would make it very difficult for the state to respond. So we're not talking just about a bonding bill or state debt. We're talking about the needs of the citizens and how that would be funded. But, Mr. Chairman, I would also like to just take a look at the summary of the list here of states that have this kind of a proposal. First of all, if you've followed the difficulties that other states are facing, California and Colorado have horrendous problems as a result of this kind of legislation in terms of simply being able to function as states. And most recently, it's been California that's been the focus of much of that. Some of it driven by the same issues I was talking about earlier. Also, if you take a look at that list, at least half the states aren't exactly what we would call states that come to the forefront of being the very best places to live and work. Many of them are states that have a rather long history of having economic difficulty and really not necessarily being in the mainstream of America in terms of the educational level of their citizens and in terms of the income levels of their citizens. Minnesota, for example, has invested well through the years in K-12 and higher education, and that's provided huge dividends for us. And many of the states on your list here haven't done that kind of thing, and so they've lagged behind the rest of the nation in terms of the types of jobs they have, the quality of jobs they have. And you can respond to that, Mr. Krenke, if you'd like, but I think you've got a list there of states that, when I see Mississippi, I'm not sure that I want Minnesota to follow in the footsteps of a state like Mississippi. Thank you.
Mr. Krenke?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, I certainly understand the concern you may have, but as I've heard around the table here, and I've heard in many situations, that's why we have elections. If the people of the state feel that the individual has not responded to their needs and to the concerns across the state, then there's an election, and in the House, you know, that's every 2 years. So as I said, the issue of if the legislature, in the minds of the people, doesn't respond to meeting the needs of schools, public safety, health care, and education, then obviously there's an opportunity for those people to vote them out of office. And so I think the idea that somehow this is some inhibiting legislation that would not allow for tax increases, I think is a misnomer. Certainly the I voted against the idea of putting a constitutional amendment forward that would raise the sales tax to fund cultural heritage and preservation of natural resources. I felt that's the responsibility of the legislature. We shouldn't be putting that in the Constitution. But previous legislature put that on the ballot. The people of the state of Minnesota voted for a tax increase. So the idea that somehow this would prohibit or impede tax increases, it may set a higher standard, may raise the bar, but I don't think it would impede or stop this legislature or the citizens of the state voting for tax increases.
Mr. Chairman, just a concluding comment. You and I did find some common ground dealing with Ventura on an issue. I remember that. And so I think we may have found some common ground here in a sense. I think it is the election process and accountability that should determine this, however, and not a constitutional amendment with an extra high threshold that would make it very difficult for the state to respond to emergency situations or demographic changes that we all know are going to take place. If somebody did raise a tax, that's the election process. You are accountable for what your decision was and the explanation. So our difference of opinion here is whether it's in the Constitution or whether it's the election process in and of itself that takes place every 2 years in the case of a House member that would determine that.
Thank you, Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
If I could just add, Representative Carlson was looking at the list of states, and you know, as we look at them, you've got states like Michigan, South Dakota, Delaware, Oregon, not necessarily conservative southern, you know, states. So I think you've got really quite a mix of them there. And I've done a little bit of reading around Proposition 13 and some of the other amendments that are out there. That's a California amendment that placed those limitations in that state. And the public polling on these is very high. The people who have them in those states like those limitations placed on their legislature. And I'm not aware of any yet that have been repealed.
And Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment.
Yes, Representative
Carlson. I was just in Michigan not long ago, and I happened to be in the city of Detroit. And if you wanted to see a state that's in tremendous disarray recently, now there are different set of reasons, but I'm not sure Michigan is one that I would point to right now as being a state that's not with horrendous difficulty. But the states I selected were states that have a long history of not investing in the public sector, whether it's their infrastructure, whether it's their educational system, whether it's health care. There are reasons why a Minnesota and a Hawaii, for example, when I focused on health care, probably have among the highest life expectancy rate, for example, in the entire country. But I'll stop at this point. I could go on this, and I think I probably have enough already.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And I think on your list, sir, Representative Drazkowski, we need to put Wisconsin on there. I believe they recently passed a supermajority for taxing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know they were considering it. I didn't know it had passed.
I could be wrong, but I think
I will.
I could be wrong.
I will get it on there if indeed they have. Thanks.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, we have Paymar, Rukubina, Lincheski, Downey, Knuth. But what, before we start with Representative Paymar, I'd like to ask a question. Representative Drazkowski, how many more folks do you have that would like to testify in support of the bill?
I'm not certain, Mr. Chair. I know at least of one other for sure. Maybe Mr. Patrick is has an exhaustive.
Maybe a show of hands, folks who would wish to testify in support. Okay, so how many people like testify with concerns? Just try to get a feel. Okay, we're good. Okay, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I just... just a comment to Mr. Krinke. I guess I don't quite understand the logic here about elections every 2 years. As Representative Drazkowski pointed out, the voters in California enacted Prop 13, I don't know, was that 30, must have been 35 years ago. Once you have something like that constitutionally put in place, I mean, you live with it. You may think people in California like that proposition, Representative Drazkowski, but California ranks 49th in education out of 50 states. It has a lot to do with Prop 13. So my question isn't so much of Mr. Krinke, but of you, Representative Drazkowski, and I see that you have most of your leadership has signed on to your bill. And it seems to be a practice this year by the majority to be offering constitutional amendments, whether it's gay marriage or photo ID or right to work state, you name it. You've got how many at least introduced. So is it the philosophy now of the Republican Party to say that we should abandon representative democracy and move more to a proposition form style government where the voters would essentially vote on significant policy or fiscal matters? Is that the philosophy of the Republican Party? We didn't do this when we were in the majority, and I'm thinking in my tenure here, we rarely did it. I didn't vote for the sales tax constitutional amendment either. I think that's bad public policy. But I was in the minority on that one. But it does seem like we're really changing, 150 years of the way we've run government here. And is that your belief, Representative Drazkowski, that we should go that on important issues, we should always let the voters decide? Because if that's the case, then if and when we're in the majority in 2 years, I've got a host of constitutional amendments that are going to sound really good to the voters. And I guess we'll just offer them up, 10, 20, 30 of them, have them all on the ballot. So I'm just curious about that.
Representative Drazkowski, can you please describe the thoughts of the Republican Party? I'd really like to know.
He's the epitome.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Paymar, I can describe the thoughts of one Republican. And Representative Paymar, and that is many of these proposals are proposals that have been brought in the past. Republicans have not had control of both houses in before Proposition 13, as I understand. And so many of these are not new. You mentioned the right to work proposal. That's been here for at least the last 3 years that I'm aware of, probably long before. This one has been entertained in two different times in the last dozen years. And, the marriage amendment has been entertained in as probably every year since in those last dozen years, as have many, many others. And so I wouldn't suggest that the authoring of bills is any different this year than it has been in past years. The ability for these proposals to get in front of the voters is the one thing, though, that has changed.
Representative Paymar?
I wonder if you could be a little bit more specific. You're usually a straight talker, Representative Drazkowski. Is this your belief, though, that we should abandon representative democracy and move to this to a ballot initiative where we have propositions every election cycle and just vote on them and bypass the legislature? I would like your opinion on that, not as a spokesperson of the party, but your particular ideology.
Representative Drazkowski?
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, these are proposals that are brought forward for the people to respond to. They don't replace the representative republic that we have here in this country, and practically there would be no way to do it that way anyway. So the answer is no. It's not intended to replace the representative republic that we do have, but instead it's intended to put fundamental questions that voters have had that they haven't had a chance to respond to in the last several decades.
Representative Paymar?
That's enough.
Representative Rukavina?
Oh, boy. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's just always a pleasure to see Representative Krenke, your former Representative Krenke, and Representative Drazkowski together. I can only imagine the pillow talk tonight. That great,
I doubt it.
But that's a whole other issue.
Being at the House about 1590.
Yes.
That's a
matter. Well, that is part of really. Okay. Mr. Krenke, first of all, you're bringing up the constitutional requirement about debt service and the inability. If there ever is a crisis, that there is in statute or in constitution actually that reference you referred to. But Mr. Michael, how many times has it ever been used? Can you tell us?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the automatic property tax levy to pay state bonds, to my knowledge, has never been used. But
thank you.
Rukavina?
And Mr. Chair, members, that's the point. Representative Krenke, I think we've been very diligent about not getting the state in debt that would ever have been used. But, I have to comment on your comment about the sales tax for the legacy, because I also opposed that, as did Representative Paymar and you. And I recall you calling me to get some support on that, and I might add that I had one of the biggest votes against it in the state, because I don't believe we should. I think the legislature needs leeway. But, your analogy is a bad one, because you and me, I think, were the only two organizations in the state that were opposing it, and everybody else was kicking in money in their, quest to convince the taxpayers that the clean water was going to happen and the arts were going to flourish and everything else. So everybody that I can think of, from the duck hunters and the deer hunters to the, Minneapolis supporters of the symphony or whatever, were in support of it. It was a bad idea then, and this is a bad idea now. And Phil, this morning in Ways and Means, Representative Drazkowski had another bill up to abolish the program for contributing to our campaigns, and we asked, about corporate financing for elections. And we were told, I believe, that the Minnesota Taxpayers League, if I'm not mistaken, was one of the nonprofits suing the state of Minnesota on campaign financing law. So I'm wondering if, being a good Republican businessman as you are, if you were just suing, thinking about this amendment, and how much corporate Minnesota and your other friends that really don't like taxes or believe in government are already promising in this campaign to pass this constitutional amendment, where other groups that will want to fight it will have really no funds to fight it. Do you have a plan already laid in place, since you're suing on campaign finance law, for corporations to be able to get around Minnesota's corporate finance laws for campaign finance? You got a plan? I know you're always one step ahead of me. So I'm just wondering.
Representative Krenke? Mr. Krenke?
Mr. Chair and Representative Rukavina, first and foremost, the Taxpayers League has no specific plans with regard to the 2012 campaigns. We are involved in litigation concerning Minnesota's corporate ability for corporations to contribute to campaigns. I'm not sure what that has to do with this particular issue. But again, to your original point, Representative Rukavina, the response to the question, you know, has the constitutional provision which would automatically invoke a statewide property tax in order to pay state debt, the response is no, it hasn't, because the legislature has always acted judiciously in order to ensure that those bond payments were made. And so, again, whether we, as I mentioned at the outset, what we're really talking about here is that most people in the state don't realize that if the legislature doesn't appropriate the money to make the state bond payments, there is an automatic tax increase which would occur. That is and that is the premise for why there is the three-fifths majority of each body to pass obligation or general obligation bonds. So again, let me just say, this is what Representative Drazkowski is putting forward here is in essence only a clarification that you're going to have three-fifths majority vote in both houses in order to tax people to get there. Because if you don't tax people to get there, you're going to already have an automatic tax increase in place. So again, this is setting in place the precursor to say, well, if we're going to incur the spending, whether it's general obligation bonds or whether it's spending of any other type, we have to have the resources in order to meet those obligations. And so, again, I know that you said that a concern about, you know, the state hasn't gone into debt. I just might add that no thanks to you.
Well, thank you. And the question on the pillow talk? No, Mr. Chair.
We have
many. You know, Mr. Krinke and Mr. Chair, you took a quantum leap there to say that, you know, you said in part of your response that the state has acted diligently. And now you're implying that we're all going to be irresponsible and that the taxpayers should have this constitutional amendment. And my point being about you suing over campaign finances, groups like yours that have the wherewithal that are going to go out are going to raise tons of money because now corporations can give all the money they want to pass something like this. And who's going to fight it? Ask me, the teachers, the parents and grandkids of people in a nursing home. Everybody that's going to get starved with this, you know. Representative Drazkowski, if you'd answer a question. Why don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, why don't you have a constitutional amendment that says all bills at the legislature should have two-thirds to pass? Because I'll tell you, I've seen some crazy whacked-out bills, particularly this session, that should have had two-thirds. So why don't you just say everything should have two-thirds?
Representative Drazkowski?
You might actually.
Mr. Chair, well, Representative Rukavina, I don't know what you were talking about on the pillow this morning, but in 1912, there were six different constitutional amendments that went to the voters. In 1914, there were nine different constitutional amendments that went to the voters. I don't know that we're looking at six or nine different ones here, but one of them, interestingly enough, and I would relate back to the people. The people have the ability to sort the wheat from the chaff when proposals are put to them. This is merely putting a proposal to the people. 1914, to authorize a revolving fund for improving state school and swamp lands. Now, that was a proposal then, and I haven't gone through all these, Representative Rukavina, but the people will make the call on those proposals that have merit and will reject those that do not.
Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, in 1914, there wasn't federal and state law and all that that says that corporations were people that could contribute to these types of campaigns. Representative Drazkowski, why not? You didn't answer my question. Have it then that says three-fifths of the legislature should be required to pass any law, particularly yours, but mine even, you know, for that matter.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I didn't hear if that was an amendment, Representative Rukavina, but you know, I think what we want to do here is set, you know, give the people the ability to set the guideposts of the legislature, and that's what the Constitution is intended for. It's not to micromanage the legislature, but to set the boundaries within which we operate so that we can act with with the discipline and the directive of the people.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, and Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, you can't fight in today's media world something like this if one side is spending millions, as Representative Krinke alluded to, on an amendment, and the other side has no funds and nothing to work with. And Representative Drazkowski, does this apply to a fee? If we called a cigarette tax a fee like former Governor Pelenne did, if it's a statewide fee, does it need a three-fifths vote?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Rukavina, as I understand it, we do have in state law now language that says that a fee is a tax, so the answer would be yes.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if maybe we can get an interpretation from council on that, but if that's your legislative intent, at least that's somewhat, rational thinking then. Does it apply
to... Representative Walker,
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, does it apply to those sin taxes, as some people call them, like cigarettes and alcohol and gambling taxes?
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I'd maybe yield to Mr. Michael, but I understand that's a questionable area and potentially not, but I'd yield to
Mr. Michael,
the council.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rukavina, I think it would depend upon whether the nature of the tax would be considered to be a sales tax. I mean, we characterize those as excise taxes, and the cigarette tax, for example, is imposed on a per cigarette basis. And so I think, although it's the sale that may trigger the tax, I mean, there are going to be questions here as to, was the intent of this to say it's something like a general sales tax, or would an excise tax, if it's triggered by a sale, become subject to it? So I can't really definitively tell you the answer. My opinion would be that this would likely not apply to per unit excise taxes.
Well, so
John Brookvina,
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, there again, these taxes I just mentioned, the sin taxes, I've said this before, I'll say it again, where I come from, the biggest sin is greed. And, there seems to be a lot of greed going around today, from the banksters in Wall Street on down. But, what this does then is regressive taxes can be increased by the legislature, but fair taxes can't be. And furthermore, I would like to know, before I shut up, Mr. Chair, if a local unit of government that wanted to pass like a excess operating levy would have to go to the voters for three-fifths.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rukavina, the language in regard to that is on lines 1.16 and 1.17 of the bill. So if it requires the approval of the voters, it would not be covered by the amendment. But if it is a property tax, and if you would validate this, Mr. Michael, if a property tax is a property tax that can normally be increased by a board, then it would be covered by the amendment. That's what I understand. Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I think I would agree with the way Representative Drazkowski characterized this. I mean, keep in mind that it applies to actions of the legislature, first off. So, and then basically what it says in Clause 1 is amended, if the legislature increases, if the only way that the local government can impose this increased property tax is because the legislature either authorized them or raised, either by giving them the authority to levy the property tax or increase the levy limit, then that law would require a three-fifths approval. But if they've got general authority to raise the property tax already, and they raise the property tax, that would not involve this authority at all. And secondly, there is an exception that in the case, for example, you mentioned excess operating referenda, those generally do require voter approval, so the legislature could, say, increase the cap on excess levy referenda, but because they're subject to voter approval, it would only require a simple majority. Whereas if it increases a levy limit that does not require voter approval, then the legislature would have to approve that levy limit increase by a supermajority.
So, Mr. Chair and members, again, here we have districts and counties and cities that do not have much property wealth for whatever reason that we've tried to, make somewhat equal throughout the state of Minnesota with school fundings, local government aids, county aids, that now would make our whole system more unfair, even depending on where you live. And finally, Mr. Chair, Michael, Representative, the chair has a bill that lowers taxes and lowers aids, and the Office of Management and Budget and others say that it's going to increase property taxes statewide by, I believe, Representative Lincheski, by about 50% would be charged back. And so would Representative a bill being offered by the tax chair to cut local government aid and some other taxes that's indicated by all the experts around here, nonpartisan experts, that would increase property taxes across the state by 50%. Would that require then the vote of the people of the state to pass Representative David's tax bill?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, that this amendment, essentially changes the parameters for what majority it takes to pass certain bills in the legislature. And because, with regard to property taxes, by its terms, if you look again on lines 1.6 and 1.7, it's basically in terms of authorization or limits on levies. And so to the extent that the bill, cuts aid to local governments, that then most of us think, well, in that creates some probability that levies will be increased. That's not implicated by this. This is basically changing the legal authority to impose property taxes without being subject to a referendum. So, for example, House File 42, which is what you're referring to, would not, if this had been in place, require a three-fifths vote to pass it, because there isn't, and maybe Pat's coming here to tell me that there is a change in some levy limit in House File 42 that presumably would have required that. But basically that's the issue. Is there something in the bill that would essentially increase the legal authority to impose property tax levies by local governments? It's not just because there's an aid reduction that it would trigger it. So that's the operative question.
Mr. Michael, I believe it was 1.16 and 1.17. You said 1.6 and 1.7. Oh, as amended? Okay. Representative Rukavina.
No, I'm perplexed.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I do think there is kind of a nuance to that needs to be considered. If levy limits are in place, because the way we have written levy limits, the way levy limits are written into our law, they are a levy, they're a limit on levy plus aid. If you are decreasing aids, that would be an increase into the levy limit or the authorized levy limit. And so I think under those circumstances, as long as you had levy limits, that would require a supermajority to cut aids.
Oh, boy.
Mr. Rukavina?
Well, Mr.
We don't have levy.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, these are things I've, been questioning, thinking about this, and, we'd probably be moving quicker or slowly in the future years if this passes as we are this year to getting anything done around here.
Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I see Representative Krenke is still there, so I'm hoping I can ask him a question. I think that's what we're on, and I do have a number of questions for Representative Drazkowski, but I don't know how you're
handling.
Why
don't we go with questions for the witness that testified? Representative Drazkowski will have plenty of time to talk to him, too.
Okay.
Representative Lincheski, to Mr. Krenke, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative or Mr. Krenke, yeah, I've thought a lot about these sorts of provisions, and I don't know if you were in the room when the hearing started, but you know what's been proposed in past years in 99 and 01, this is not the same. So there was some reference that this is kind of the same, not the same. And interestingly, I was looking at the vote, and there were for and against bipartisan on those votes. They were not ideological votes. There were Democrats and Republicans both voting for them and against them. So I think, you know, this is a very different sort of bill. But you were discussing the bonding piece, and, you know, we already have a property tax backs the bonding, which is accurate. Of course, you know, there's other things like that going on locally, the Met Council, a bunch of places where that happens. And I always thought about those bonding provisions as that is the intergenerational or the multi-generational equity argument, that the taxpayers who aren't voting every other year in the Minnesota House but are paying for this project for 30 years get a little coverage there when it's a supermajority. Elections handle the rest of the spending, and the bonding spending, you know, is a very minuscule part of the state budget, as you know. You know, close to 80% is in two areas that don't really have anything to do with bonding. So the constitutional relation to bonding and backing up with a tax of a requiring a supermajority vote, I think, is sort of a distraction to the issue here, because it's just a small piece. That's my personal opinion. We have a number of sort of gateway mechanisms right now to make it tough to pass a tax or to do much of anything. You know, we're always working on the margin. For example, we have budget resolution. The majority parties set the budget resolution, and that's when they decide. They set targets, and that's when they decide. And while Mr. Michael can go into great detail to explain to us why the Constitution nowhere says we have a balanced budget amendment in the state, we do, because of the way the number of the provisions in the Constitution work together. So already we have a lot of stuff going on. You know, we have to balance our budget. We have budget resolutions that the majority is in charge of. We have a targeting process. So, you know, those apply to all things, raising, spending. And it's just been my observation watching the legislature and having been fortunate to be in both the majority and the minority. And I spent my first 8 years in the minority. And there's really four things you can do. You can spend more. You can cut spending. You can tax more. You can cut taxes. And the hardest thing right now without this is to raise taxes. Doesn't matter who's in charge. Bipartisanly, it's just my subjective view. Both Republicans and Democrats love to spend. I know one party likes to say that they do it and the other doesn't, but that's not what my observation is. You watch the people who carry the bills through. Everybody's trying to spend. Actually, cutting is much easier, and historically, if you actually go and look at every biennium for the last 10, there's been much more cutting than raising of taxes, and bipartisanly. I mean, it didn't matter who was in charge. There's been much more cutting. And then, you know, there's tax cuts, lots of those. I voted for all those, 99, 2001, 2002, 2003. You know, it's easy to vote for tax cuts. We all do it. So I already think.
Yourself on that one.
All right. So, you know, I would say of the four actions, just watching everyone bipartisanly, the hardest thing to do, no matter what your philosophy around here, is to raise taxes. So I think there's already a lot of protections going on. But, you know, I respect that Representative Drazkowski is saying, you know, we need even more. And so, I just want to think about that. And okay, so if that happens, because I voted for some of these, but not this one. And, you know, what is the adverse impacts if this passes on the ballot that people maybe aren't thinking about? So I'm just trying to think of how these tricky legislators bipartisanly will be even trickier, and they always are. So, you know, one of the things I've thought of is what do people do now to avoid that? And we're seeing it right now. The majority budget that's before us and before the governor already has all kinds of hidden revenue in it. And it tells me that, you know, folks don't want to raise taxes because politically we know it's the most damning thing a legislator can do. So the new majority has over $1 billion of new revenue built into its budget. It's not in this chair's budget. It's not in House File 42. This chair, David's, has done what I did and you did, Representative Krenke, is we all cut aids and credits, and that raised revenue, and then it was spent in other places. So those are revenue-raising techniques, and that happens bipartisanly. But what's also happening right now is because of setting aside the property tax increases or the removal of state aids and credits to not be too, you know, hostile here in language, but to remove state aids and credits, thereby reducing spending in the tax aids and credits portion of the budget to use the revenue elsewhere, we're witnessing right now the unwillingness to cut further. And so first off, and all parties have done this, you know, what's the big thing first is everybody's shifting. Dayton's shifting. The Republicans are shifting. The Democrats shifted. So first of all, that's what do legislators find the easiest to do? Shift. You know, that's just, everybody does it. We don't want to raise taxes on people. We don't want to cut their services. So that's already in all the budgets, you know, bipartisanly. The next thing people do is and I think this is bipartisan, they try to cut for a while. And at some point, and I think this is where the parties get a little different, one party will cut a little deeper, a little longer, and the other will stop a little sooner. But my estimation watching this is one party tends to more say, okay, so now we're at our limit, now we're going to do some revenue. The other party says, now we're at our limit, now we're going to do some hidden revenue that we're not going to call a tax increase, we're not going to carry it in the tax bill, but we're going to put this, you know, $700 million in a global waiver, we're going to stick $100 million in Lanning's bill, we're going to stick $60 million of the, you know, Iron Range money in the Gunther bill. And so all of these are being called not revenue, and, you know, we know they are. They're revenue to avoid cutting. And can you just tell me, as someone who's not part of this whole action right now, put yourself back in the chair. And I, you know, I recall and I respect that when the tax bill was getting closed, when you and Senator Pogemiller were doing it, you removed yourself as chair because you were unwilling to go down that road. Representative Abrams took over as the chair of that conference committee and closed the bill. And you were very honest, and I respect you for what you were doing there because you were unwilling to raise that revenue. And so I understand that. But as much as you can step back, can you comment on how a bill like Representative Drazkowski's, would it do anything to stop the revenue hiding that's going on right now? I mean, I personally don't see it. I don't think it moves that issue around at all. And if you can just, you know, as nonpartisanly as possible. I know it's hard to do here, and I'm trying to do it on this because I've supported some of these in the past. You know, how do you avoid that? I don't see that this gets at that.
Mr. Krenke?
Well, let me, if I might, Mr. Chair, I think to try to respond to Representative Lynn Chesky's inquiry, maybe a question of staff, and that is if there was a reduction in tax expenditures, i.e., if there was a tax deduction that was removed, what would the requirement under this legislation be?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krenke, it would require, because that would expand the taxable base of a state tax, if it was an income or a sales tax or a property tax, it would require a three-fifths vote.
Mr. Krenke?
So if changing the tax code would result in a three-fifths vote, I mean, if changing the tax code to remove a tax expenditure or a tax exemption would require a three-fifths vote, I still believe, Representative Lincheski, what this would do is shed a lot more light on the process. Again, as I said in response to Representative Carlson's question, there, as we are all familiar with the idea that it's, as you point out, it's easy to vote for the expenditure. It's easy to vote for more funding for K-12 education. It's easy to vote to provide the state service. It's not as easy to come up with the funds to pay for that service. And so, yes, again, I think what this does is that it sheds more light on the process. It raises the bar so that you don't as easily or as simply come up with those quote-unquote hidden sources of revenue. Again, let me point out that I disagree with the tax chairman's approach to increased revenue by saying there are businesses and individuals out there that aren't paying the appropriate amount of tax, and therefore we should spend more to go find them. That creates a significant burden on individuals and businesses around the state, as you know, for other reasons. But I think by raising the bar, by saying that it takes a greater number of people to actually vote for that revenue increase, that tax increase, you're going to hopefully put more pressure on the spending side of the equation, because as you said, there is a implied balanced budget requirement in the Constitution, and you can't leave here supposedly without having a balanced budget in place. So let's put a higher standard, a higher requirement on legislators to pass those tax increases, because as you point out, the spending is much easier than it is on the revenue side of the equation.
Mr. Krenke, the issue you have concerns with is not in House File 42.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Will, you still have the floor. I'd like to ask this question. The debate here is fascinating, but I was wondering if there is anyone that's driven in from some distance that has come to testify or taken off work. We may set Mr. Krenke in the line of questioning aside to take. Is there anyone that couldn't come back tonight at 6:30? Okay, so we will get to your testimony before 2:15. So I think we're good right now. Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Krenke, maybe what I guess what I'm trying to hit on here, and I heard you agree, but there's these other things that folks have put into finance bills, and they're not calling them revenue, but they are. So this constitutional amendment, which would require 60% of legislators to vote yes to pass a tax, would do nothing to address the other ways to raise revenue. And in fact, it feels like it would actually, you know, it would actually push more of them through. So, for example, you know, you're the tax chair, and you've been before. Now you've said, I'm laying down the gauntlet, I'm not raising revenue, and you are trying to herd in as much revenue out there that the finance chairs are carrying around, but your leadership's going to let them carry revenue. And you know, you used to try to stop them. I always try to stop them. All revenue is supposed to be in the revenue committee. But chairs, finance chairs are creative. And so let's say you lose that fight. You know, I won that fight. I had all the revenue sitting in the tax bill. Right now, there's lots of revenue not in the tax bill. This amendment for a law right now, voters that pass it, would do nothing to stop that. Nothing. Finance chairs could still make up revenue and stack their bills with it. Thereby, this protection that supposedly the taxpayers are going to get through this constitutional amendment, they're not going to get anyhow. It just creates even more hidden sort of perverse items. And that's what I'm having a hard time getting. I will just say, Representative Krenke, I think this is where you and I would disagree, is I understand that this sort of gives you another, you know, the conservative philosophy on this, another tool to sort of win the day. Just like the budget balancing requirement does in state law, and I'm a big fan of that. I'm glad we have that. And the targeting process and the resolutions process. But it gives you another one, which is to say that 41% of all legislators, no matter who's in charge around here, can stop any revenue forevermore. Doesn't matter who's in charge, Democrats or Republicans. 41% of legislators don't want revenue, there won't be any. Even if the voters elect a governor and two bodies that clearly want revenue, they have to have 60% of everything to do it. And you know, I don't get where that jives with the United States Constitution and where, you know, representational government comes in, as Representative Paymer was saying. You know, I will say, I think, you know, not to you, Representative Krenke, or even to you, Representative Drazkowski, just to anybody, I think these are kind of gimmicks that are, you know, without, I don't mean this insulting, I think it's kind of cowardly. And the reason I say that is what Representative Paymer said. You know, for 4 years, the House and Senate were Democratic, just like right now. We never passed a one. We could have done that. We could have put our whole agenda on the ballot, picked all the ones we knew the voters would pass, and it just seems like, you know, who's afraid of democracy? I mean, my goodness. But, you know, it's a different day, and that's what people want to do. We never did that. And, you know, Representative Rukavina and Representative Paymer and Representative Krenke, I don't know who voted for that sales tax amendment, but I fought it too. And I think bipartisanly we all lost. And this just shows, you know, the voters went out and passed it. But most people understand tax policy bipartisan. Senator Bach, he fought it too. All kinds of people fought it, but yet it happened. So, you know, I guess, you know, I'm going to take a look at this, but I really think we have to think long and hard about this. Again, when the Democrats had the House and Senate for 4 years, nobody did any of these, and we could have passed Governor Plenty, and said, you can never cut education, or you can never, you know, whatever we wanted to do, but we didn't. And I really hope legislators will think about this, and I hope you'll talk to your leadership about it. I think there's a lot of problems with these kind of provisions that sound really good in 2011, but another day, different perspective, but appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Lencheski. Representative Downey, Knuth, Dabney, and at some point here we're going to get to the gentleman that wishes to testify with concerns. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple thoughts and then two questions for Mr. Krinke. First of all, we're talking about the difference between amendments and passing laws to enact public policy. And I think the amendments that we're looking at in this legislative session do rise to the merit of the Constitution. And in fact, this particular one, I don't think we could pass a bill. I think it's Article 4, Section 22. I did a quick look. Says that it takes a majority of the legislature to pass a bill. So if we want to give the legislature or restrict the legislature's authority to pass something and limit it to 60% threshold, we'd have to do a constitutional amendment. So I think this one is of necessity, appropriately a ballot question. Just a couple of other thoughts as I'm hearing the debate. There was some criticism of the states on the list that have these kinds of protective measures, and I was looking at some of them, Washington State being held out often as an example of somebody that really has a good priority-based budgeting mechanism out there. So I don't think that list necessarily implies that we're looking at the low end of states when we embark on something like this. And I really like this proposal. I think it's great. It's going to force us to think about spending first. It's going to force us to think about our priorities before going to revenue. And I think it's going to help us avoid the easy impulse to come to the legislature and raise revenue through the state for local and other means where frankly, local control should prevail. And this idea that, gee, somehow in an emergency we wouldn't be able to pass a bill, I'm guessing if there were a true emergency, you'd have no problem finding 60% of the vote. But here's my question for Mr. Krinke. My observation of bonding bills is that the way they pass with 60% is that you got to load them up with a bunch of pork. And so my potential fear on this, and maybe you have some experience from other states, is that do you find that state legislatures only pass revenue bills when they've loaded them up big enough with a bunch of spending and a bunch of goodies to get them through? In other words, do we end up just making revenue increasers more expensive and higher taxation as compared to the reverse? Any evidence that occurs?
Mr. Krinke?
Well, I'm not going to try to speculate on what happens in other states. I've spent my...
Let's go through the chair, Mr. Krinke.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Downey. I'm not going to speculate on what happens in other states. My entire life, save a few years in Iowa for higher education, has been spent in Minnesota. And I'm a strong believer in the 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution, that states' rights. The state of Minnesota has the right, the power, and the privilege to do what we choose to do here, and we don't necessarily have to look at whether other states do or don't do. To your point, the chair of the Capital Investment Committee some years ago, I hopefully put in place that you don't have to load up a bonding bill with lots of pork projects in order to pass it. I believe the House passed a bill in 2004 with 120 votes that was smaller than what the Governor Pawlenty's recommendation for a bonding bill was. So I think given in the inclusionary process, given strong view of what is important to all citizens of the state of Minnesota, you can pass a prudent budget, you can pass a prudent bonding bill without loading it up with a bunch of special projects.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a following question. So it would only take a majority vote to put an amendment on the ballot. Is there a fear that then with the threshold of 60% for revenue increases that we might gravitate even more towards legacy amendment type revenue raisers in your mind?
Mr. Krinke.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I don't believe so. I think, again, we know that the constitutional requirement to pass a a ballot measure in the state of Minnesota is higher than the simple majority. As you know, it is the it's a majority of those people voting in the affirmative. So again, when we put this issue to the people, I don't think they're going to be looking to somehow find or subvert the process to load up other constitutional amendments or find other ways to spend money just because there's this three-fifths majority imposed upon the legislature.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be for Representative Krinke. I'd be interested in his answer as a representative of the Taxpayers League, or if I can't remember which one.
It's League.
Yeah. Thank you. And maybe I'd also be interested in Representative Druskowski's. You know, we have this handout, a summary of state protections for taxpayers. You can see I draw ants when I'm in committee, so that's at the top of that as well. But I'm just curious, you know, as an elected representative, taxes are definitely important, but I feel like I represent citizens. And do you think taxpayers or citizens are more important when we look at our state policies and our Constitution?
Mr. Krinke?
Well, let me answer this way, that there are a lot of Minnesotans that receive benefits under numerous state programs but don't pay taxes. So I think the common, they don't pay income taxes. Let me be much more specific. So we all know that it's easy to impose a tax it's easier to raise taxes on some group or some individuals and spread the benefits to everyone than it is for people to directly vote to raise taxes on the group of individuals which are the beneficiaries. Again, certainly we talk about shared sacrifice, but when it comes to the benefits that are received, but we don't really talk about shared sacrifice when it comes to the people who are paying the majority of income taxes in the state of Minnesota. So when you say citizen versus taxpayer, there is a difference. It might be a nuance to some people, but when you have a very small minority of people paying a significant portion of the income taxes, and say then those individuals should pay more for the benefit of all. Again, the question becomes, where is the quote-unquote issue of fairness? Where is the question of equity? Same thing is true in terms of property taxes as well. Just because you live in a higher valued home doesn't mean you receive any more in local government services, yet you pay considerably more, particularly if you have a home worth over $500,000. So I don't think you can just say citizen and equate it to taxpayer.
Representative Knuth?
Oh, I'd be curious in Representative Druskowski's answer, but I'd agree, Mr. Krinke, that citizens and taxpayers are not necessarily the same thing. And I think voting to cut services for, say, disabled children or our school children who may or may not be paying any taxes, I think that's a hard thing to do. It hits you in the gut, and it should, because what we're doing here impacts people's lives in way more ways than the taxes they pay to the state of Minnesota. And certainly we need to be looking at the taxes Minnesotans pay and what the form of those is, how much, but we need to think about what they pay for. And the idea of just having protections for taxpayers in our state constitution and not thinking about the citizens that we represent here as much more complex and I think interesting and important than just as a taxpayer, I think does a disservice to the legislature and the people of Minnesota, and to enshrine that in our Constitution is a really bad direction for the state of Minnesota. And I know, you know, you probably, you might have spouses or children, you're embedded in a community, and I would hope that you don't wake up in the morning and go to bed thinking that it's all about those taxes. My life would be great if it just wasn't for those taxes. It's everything around that as citizens that we care about. And I think as elected representative citizens, to enshrine the rights of only taxpayers in our Constitution is a really bad direction for the state of Minnesota. And you'll probably say we have other protections for citizens in our Constitution, as we should, and we do. But I think to elevate just protections for taxpayers into the level of the Constitution, I think, is a really bad direction. And I would hope that you think of the people you represent as much more broadly than taxpayers, and rather as citizens and whole people.
Mr. Drazkowski?
I would just add, Mr. Chair and Representative Knuth, that you know, I think we all hope that that all citizens are taxpayers, and certainly taxpayers are citizens. And it was when I was knocking on doors this last year, it was citizens I talked to. I didn't ask them whether they paid taxes or how much they paid, but I heard overwhelmingly that our government has to again be accountable to the people, and the message was that it's not, that it just continues to tax and spend. And you know, that's the genesis of this proposal. And I think if we look back on the election results, it was those people with messages that they were going to come back to the legislature and bring some accountability in our spending and stop the taxing of our population. 33 of them came, and 33 with the other message didn't, you know, came. So, you know, I think they're both important. I think you're right. And probably, you know, the title probably shouldn't be specifically taxpayers, but it is taxpayers that are paying the bill here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, I wasn't going to respond, but Representative Drazkowski, the people of Minnesota overwhelmingly voted for a gubernatorial candidate who was saying that we wanted to increase taxes. Whether it was Mark Dayton or Tom Horner, both had tax increase proposals. It was different proposals, but you add those two vote totals together, and you have an overwhelming majority of Minnesotans having voted for candidates who are going to put tax increases on the table. And to argue that if you do support some new taxes doesn't mean you're not accountable, you don't want fiscal accountability. I want fiscal accountability, and I want to make sure we put Minnesota on firm fiscal footing. And the idea of over $1 billion of new revenue, either raiding it from another fund or counting money that's not really there, that's not fiscal accountability in my book. And so I think it's a flimsy argument to say that Minnesotans this year didn't want for their fiscally responsible budget, they just thought that meant no new taxes, because they overwhelmingly voted for candidates that were willing to increase taxes at the statewide level.
Hey, Representative Dabney. Mr. Chair, I've got a number of questions for Representative Drazkowski, but my understanding is we're just focused on Mr. Krinke at this time.
Former Representative Krinke, and then we'll take some other testifiers, and we'll all have questions for Representative Drazkowski. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Mr. Krinke, earlier in your comments, you suggested that this measure was a needed counter, and that's a quote, to the willingness or instinct to raise revenues and spending. Isn't that what elections are for?
Mr. Krinke?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Dabney, yes, certainly. But again, my point earlier was that there's an implied provision in the Constitution when it comes to general obligation debt, that there is already a 3/5 vote requirement. So, again, saying that it doesn't apply to, obviously, state general fund, but this provision would help to balance, in my view, that approach to, again, easy to spend the money, not as easy to raise the money.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, but Mr. Krinke, it hasn't been easy to raise the money. I've been here 11 years now. You certainly made sure for a stretch of that it wasn't easy to raise the money. Former Governor Pawlenty made sure that it wasn't easy to raise the money. I've certainly got constituents in my district that don't want me to raise the money. Representative Knuth is right. A majority of Minnesotans do want us to raise money as part of a balanced approach to the budget. But the election seems to be working to many people's frustration, a minority, a majority, I'm not sure, on any given day. But why would we take this away from the democratic process? Small d, just to assure you.
Mr. Krinke.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm not quite sure what you're talking about. Is that there have been many people who have elected officials, including the governor, who stood against general tax increases. But in the previous 2 years, general taxes in the state of Minnesota have been increased by over $1 billion, and revenue projections for the next 2 years are over $3 billion of increased revenue. So I'm not quite sure what you say or what you're talking about when you say that taxes haven't gone up in the state of Minnesota.
Representative Dabney?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Krinke, let me refine my point. I voted to raise income taxes to increase the rate. In fact, I did it just a couple of days ago in this very committee. But I haven't been successful. Aren't elections the counter that we have to instincts of a legislature or a governor or a city council or a county board to either go too far on spending or too far on reductions in spending or limitations on spending?
Mr. Krinke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devin, yes, you're absolutely correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Devin. Okay, thank you, Mr. Krinke. We'll now move on to Mr. Kedrowski. If you could join us, please, sir. Thank you, Mr. Krinke. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Jay Kedrowski. I'm a senior fellow at the Public and Nonprofit Leadership Center at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you allowing me to speak so I didn't have to come back tonight. I have other things.
You can come back. That's fine. But
yeah, thank you. I appear today as a former state finance commissioner, a businessman, and a public finance university faculty member. I do not represent today the University of Minnesota. I oppose the proposed constitutional amendment before you today, not because it proposes to limit taxation, but because it's a dangerous governance and counter to the state fiscal history of well-functioning representative republic. Governing fiscally by constitutional amendment is simply a bad idea and has led to bad consequences wherever it has been used. Let me give you some examples. First, the once prosperous state of California adopted Proposition 13, which limited property tax increases in 1978. It also has a constitutional provision requiring a supermajority for tax increases. California is in total fiscal disarray, using budget gimmicks, deferring current costs, making undeliverable promises for the future, and borrowing short term. Because it has not been able to govern fiscally effectively, it has the lowest credit rating of any of the 50 states. Second, supermajority tax increase requirements negatively impact state and local credit ratings. I've had the pleasure of representing the state of Minnesota at the rating agencies for 5 years. I represented the city of Minneapolis at the rating agencies for 5 years. And in business, I was responsible for a municipal bond underwriting operation. I think I understand something about the rating agencies, and this is not something that they want states to do. It's an impingement on the ability to raise revenues. Rating agencies want states to be consistently well-managed and have no impingements on raising revenues. Lower credit ratings, of course, result in higher costs to all the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Third, supermajority tax increase requirements don't respond to demographic changes. In the 1960s, Republicans in Minnesota appropriately raised taxes needed for new schools and colleges to meet the post-war baby boom. The Minnesota Budget Trends Study Commission, appointed by Governor Pawlenty and the House and the Senate, found that by 2020, just 9 years from now, there will be more seniors and youth than there are working people in the state of Minnesota. This dependency ratio, which is set at a historic low currently, will rise to nearly 70% by 2030. That's 30% working and 70% not working. If you were to adopt this approach, you'd be setting the standard of no tax increase at the very time when the ratio is the lowest, knowing that it's going to be going to 70% by 2030. Higher costs for today's services will be required at the very same time there will be less revenue from existing taxes in years to come. Fourth, supermajority tax increase requirements don't respond well to emergencies. If excess dollars are needed for tornado damage like Alabama's disaster, for a pandemic, fear we would have one, or even a world war, a minority of legislators can demand something unreasonable to pass a tax increase for those horrendous situations. California's history shows us just how disrupting this can be. If you read at all any of the fiscal history of what California has gone through in attempting to govern fiscally, you'll understand this point more. Fifth, supermajority tax increase requirements impede tax reform. Eliminating tax expenditures could be stalled by a minority of legislators. Let me repeat that. Eliminating tax expenditures could be stalled by a minority of legislators. I repeat that because I served this past year on the group that, in fact, did the tax expenditure report for the Department of Revenue. I commend your reading that report. It goes into great detail about the illogic of some of our tax expenditures in the state of Minnesota. Under this provision, as I understand it, any tax expenditure would have to have three-fifths majority approval, meaning that a minority legislator could, in fact, stop a good tax reform from occurring. Finally, if these reasons are not convincing enough to you, and I suspect to many of the Republicans to hear today they aren't, think about what might happen if rule by constitutional amendment becomes Minnesota's approach to governing fiscally. The next time there is a DFL majority in the House and Senate, they will likely put their flavor of constitutional amendment on the ballot. And let's think about what that might be. Remember that Oregon in 2009 passed a referendum to increase income tax rates on the wealthiest of their residents. Is that what the DFL will do when they come back into control?
Representative Marquardt, to that point.
No, I'm just writing things down.
Okay, Mr. Kadowski.
My point being is that you're with this proposal that you have in front of you, this puts Minnesota on a very slippery slope of governance by constitutional amendment, and it's not something that should be done fiscally, and this should be rejected. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to respond to any questions that members of the committee have.
Thank you, sir, for your testimony. Representative Downey, then Rukavina. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for staff. I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So you could, with a simple majority, eliminate a tax expenditure so long as you reduced taxes in other areas. Is that true?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, that is, essentially there is a revenue neutrality out so that if you are not increasing taxes, it only requires a simple majority.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Are there questions for Mr. Kudrowski? Thank you very much, sir. for your testimony. We'll go back to Representative Drazkowski's, if there's anyone who wishes to testify on behalf of the bill. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Well, my name is Noreen Dillon, and I'm here myself as a private citizen. I happen to live in Plymouth. I came here at the request of Representative Drazkowski. He knows that I have taken quite an interest. We worked together 2 years ago on a project looking at the state budget of how we could balance it without raising any taxes. And it was more of an academic kind of exercise because of the balance of power at the time. But I became very familiar with the state's budget, and so that's why he asked me to come today. I have come today to speak in favor of this measure. Again, a lot of some of the questioning and the discussion has made it sound like that, you know, by passing this, that you're making the decision, and you're not. You're allowing, you know, just people like me to be able to vote on it. I think that it really does. One of the things that I've been struck with, as well as some of the testimony here, is, you know, there's been some partisan jabs going back and forth talking about Democrats and Republicans. I think one of the strengths of this measure is that you are going to have to build consensus in order to pass taxes and to raise the revenue. I don't think that's a bad thing. To see more cooperation between the parties and between the members of these bodies in order to raise revenue on the people of Minnesota. You know, and some of the other, especially the last testifier, talked about the risk of fiscal governance. And I think oftentimes when you put yourself in charge of your own oversight, you have the tendency to maybe not always be quite objective in that. So I do see this as a, you know, a good thing for taxpayers, because what we will have in order to increase taxes is to have more cooperation and collaboration here at the legislature. Because, quite frankly, I do think that the easier it is to raise taxes is you take the focus off of the spending. I was a candidate last year, became quite so interested in the situation. I was a candidate last year for the state Senate. And one of the things that I was very struck by is we have been on a very unsustainable course here in the state. Since 1960, personal incomes have been growing at about 7% per year, but the state spending until the last biennium grows at 10%. Clearly, one is going to overtake the other unless you can deal with the spending. So it is very easy to spend other people's money, and I think that this is a way to protect that for the citizens of Minnesota. I kind of think that there are some other things I could say, but I'll stand for questions, because I think the point is kind of clear, that I think I speak in favor of this. I'd like to have the citizens be able to vote on having a higher threshold for the body's ability to raise our taxes. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dillon. Any questions from members for Ms. Dillon? Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Dillon. Appreciate the fact that you've spent some time looking at the budget in some depth. We don't always have people who have done that. But I'm wondering, you know, I think Representative Downey raised some good points about how to get around these limitations. I think we would be doing a lot more of shifts and gimmicks and delaying payment dates and the kinds of things that we have seen a lot of in order to bring revenue to the table that isn't going to be subject to this. And to me, that's not very transparent, and it really does shift the burden to others. And I'm wondering how much you've looked at how much that has been a part of the governing budget approaches over recent history, and how that might be accelerated with this kind of a barrier.
Ms. Dillon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think that the way that we solved the last biennium, I mean, we took one-time money from the federal government. We shifted payments to the schools. We borrowed from funds. I mean, that is not a transparent, it's not an honest solution. But it goes it goes to the problem that I think that we have here with governance. It's one of the reasons why I chose to run, is I don't think that we are being very honest. You know, there was one thing that I learned when I was out door knocking last year, is that people would much rather hear a pleasant lie than an unpleasant truth. And I think an awful lot about what goes on with our budgeting process is telling these little unpleasant pleasant lies. The pleasant lies are what we tell each other because we're too afraid to tell that unpleasant truth. But we are on an unsustainable course here in this state with spending. And, you know, I think that until we have some, you know, perhaps some representation that is willing to stand up and to tell those unpleasant truths, it's not the problem of this bill necessarily or of this measure. It kind of goes to some of the habits of, you know, what has just become, unfortunately, I think, a practice that doesn't benefit the regular citizens of the state.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dillon, I think I agree with you that we should be doing things up front and transparently. I have to say that I think both sides have at various times not always been demonstrated that, but I have to say it's really hard for me to have this kind of a proposal, which I think will increase this kind of game playing even more at a time when, you know, I sit on the Health and Human Services Committee and we have a wish and a prayer for a magic medical waiver that the Obama administration would approve, and that somehow that would result in major, major changes that will save hundreds of millions of dollars that haven't been outlined or even sketched. And the end result will be that we'll just have to slash and burn our health and human services system when that wish and a prayer doesn't come true in a time frame that's reasonable for a balanced budget. And so, to me, by putting a supermajority, you actually encourage people to play those games rather than voting straight up for very transparent, credible receivables, which is revenue raising. And it is hard. It is hard to, especially in this economics time, to talk about, you know, what is the economic consequences of increasing revenues. And a lot of us has been having that discussion with our constituents in, I think, a pretty straightforward way. And to me, this would actually discourage that kind of dialogue, because I think it really would, given the nature of human nature and the precedents that have been set here, I think we would see even more shifts and gimmicks and a lack of transparency in order to avoid this, or we would have trade-offs. And you'd have one part of the state saying, to get our part of the delegation, and sometimes the regional differences are greater than the political differences, that one part of the state would say, well, we're only going to put our votes up if we get X. And I think we have had a budget process that has served over the past 150-some years the citizens, I think, pretty well. And when it hasn't, there's been a change in both leadership and governance and by the people. And so I really do think, I appreciate your work, but I do think you need to think really hard about why have we seen this increasing use of these techniques and whether or not this would actually encourage that.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Carlson, it would be my intention then, after the Carlson question, to go into recess. And members, if you put your things you want to save back in your folder, we will be switching rooms at 6:30 to room 5. It would be my intention at 6:30 to take up the Dean bill, House File 1584, coming back and wrapping up this bill, House File 1598. And then we'll go to the Garofalo bill, House File 1303. So please keep anything you want back in your packet. But I shouldn't have maybe made the announcements here, because I want to pay attention here to Representative Carlson's question.
Mr. Chairman, my question actually is not of the witness, but it's of you. And I would ask the same question of a few other committee chairs. These constitutional amendments that are coming forward can't go on the ballot until 2012. And here we're spending a good deal of time in taxes, but other committees are doing the same thing. There's going to be four up in Ways and Means on Wednesday. And the question is, why are we taking up these constitutional amendments the first year of the biennium when we have a $5 billion shortfall that we have to get resolved? And the only thing that happens is that they ultimately end up in the Rules Committee, which will hold them for a decision next year. in terms of which ballot or which constitutional amendments that are going on the ballot. And I think there's at least six or seven that I can recall that are now going through the process, four of which will be, as I say, coming up Wednesday in Ways and Means. So coming back tonight's fine. I'm going to be here anyway because Ways and Means this meeting. But why are we doing it the first year of the biennium as opposed to the second year when that's when the decision would be made as to which amendments go on the ballot?
Well, I think that would be a question for Representative Drazkowski and the others carrying these. They came forward and asked for a hearing, and I granted the hearing on it. I think one of their answers has been that they want people to be talking about this over the summer and into the fall, and so when we go into next year, it'll be something that they are well aware of. You'd have to ask Representative Drazkowski, and he did get pulled to civil law, so maybe we could start with that question at 6:30.
Well, Representative Mr. Carlson. Chairman, you know, I was the committee chair for many years, probably 20-some-odd years, and it's your responsibility to deal with the agenda of this committee, and my concern is that we have a $5 billion shortfall that we haven't yet solved, and my point is that should be the point that we're talking about in this committee and in the conference committee that you serve on. I obviously do not, but that should be where the effort, in my view, should be going forward. And as chair of the tax committee, you're part of leadership. You determine what the agenda is. My point is there's plenty of time for constitutional amendments next year. That's when the decision will ultimately be made in rules, and I think our time would be better spent if we were working on the $5 billion shortfall that we have, but thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Carlson. With that, we will go into recess till 6:30 p.m., room 5, and folks who want to testify with concerns will be heard at that time. We are in recess. We will reconvene the Tax Committee. I will withdraw my motion at this point that House File 1598, as amended, be recommended passed in the Senate Committee on Ways and Means. I will now move House File 1584, be recommended pass.
Where would this one go?
Be recommended pass and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. So, Representative Majority Leader Dean, is that the proper motion, Ways and Means?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, just a quick procedural question. Is that 1598 temporarily withdrawn?
Yes, temporarily withdrawn. Members, it would be my intention to work on House File 1584, then bring back up House File 1598 as amended, and then go to House File 1303.
The reason I'm asking is Ways and Means is also starting at 7 o'clock, and some of us are going to have to shuttle back and forth, so I was curious.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'd just soon get all these out of here by 7.
Well, you're on Ways and Means, too, Mr. Chair.
That's right. So let's see what we can do here. Welcome, committee. And again, I make a motion to move House File 1584 to the Committee on Ways and Means. Welcome to the committee, Majority Leader Dean. And first of all, I'd like to ask, we have a few folks I'm aware who would like to testify shortly for the bill. Is there anyone that wishes to testify against the Majority Leader's bill? Seeing none, that means we move right along. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1584 deals with the Health Care Access Fund, which is the fund that funds Minnesota Care, and it is the recipient of the 2% provider tax in the state of Minnesota. What it does is the provider tax is a tax imposed upon dentists, physicians, care providers, drug wholesalers in the state of Minnesota, path labs, and other providers of health care in the state of Minnesota. And you've heard us discuss this on the House floor in the past. This bill is not mine. It's not new. It's been around for a while. But what is new is potentially federal changes within our health care program in Minnesota, and different alternatives have been proposed. Would suggest that there may be in the future a change in Minnesota Care of who qualifies for Minnesota Care and, in fact, what this tax will, in fact, do. What the bill would do is have the Department of Revenue and MMB commissioners meet every year around July 1st,
and prospectively look forward to the upcoming year starting that January. And if indeed there is a 125% projected balance within the fund, that the provider tax would be incrementally lowered to maintain a 125% balance. So as the need for this fund goes down, the tax would go down with it. That reflects current law as we have moving in. You might ask yourself, well, you say that we're going to go into deficit in this fund, and that is true within the next biennium, but then we see funds quickly accumulate into the several hundred million dollars starting in 14-15 and building. And so that is the it reflects current law and the projected fund balances within the Healthcare Access Fund. And that has been the argument over time, but with current law, the argument is refreshed. And also, I think I want to have the discussion moving forward, because I think it is very important to have a discussion about Minnesota Care, the changes within it, and also the Minnesota Care tax, which we have in the state of Minnesota. This bill was bipartisanly supported in Healthcare Committee, and also has the support of Minnesota physicians and dentists who are here, also here to support it, and also answer any questions that you might have about how this would affect local providers. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I would invite your questions and ask for your support.
Thank you. Before we go into questions, if it's okay, I'd like to, I think there's some brief testimony. Do you want to bring your witnesses up, and then
I think they will be available to answer questions as a resource, but in the interest of time, would just like to move to questions for the committee.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd just like if the majority leader would be able to, you indicated in 14 it begins to bounce back, but there's a dip. What happens in 12 and 13? Will it be adequately funded at that point?
Majority Leader Dean?
What we're seeing right now within the past 2 years, we've seen additional people move into Minnesota Care, so actually the fund balance has dropped quicker than we would have anticipated that it would have because of some changes within the health care law. This will glance down to very low balances and then begin to accumulate into 14, but it will... the projected deficit, I believe, is the last time I looked at 2013. So this would not come into effect in the upcoming biennium under current law.
It would not.
Mr.
Chairman, we wouldn't have to worry then about a deficit in 12 and 13.
No, this would.
We wouldn't be going in the red, and then we begin to bounce back in. Number or in 15 is what you're saying. I just want to make sure that there's adequate funding. Mr. Chairman, just a comment. I was here, as several others may have been, when this was actually enacted, and the House position was that it was originally to be funded from the general fund. And it came back from conference committee with the current provider tax. It was the other Carlson, Governor Carlson, one of the other Carlsons that insisted on the provider tax at the time, and it's remained as such since. So I guess I have no problem with what you're trying to do as long as we get through 12 and 13 without going into the red. So thank you.
Representative Laughlin?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. I mean, I think that Representative Dean is good to kind of look at the long term and the possibility we might not need all of these resources in the future. But I have to just say there's some, since our fiscal notes are always based on current law, I just wanted to highlight that there's a couple of proposals that will potentially influence these balances, and we're not sure exactly how. But House File 8 that we just passed last week off the House floor, Representative Gottwald's bill, would change Minnesota Care to a voucher to purchase insurance on the private market. And if people aren't able to secure, because of their pre-existing conditions or health care issues, affordable coverage in the private market, then they would go on to the MCHA fund, the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, which is our high-risk pool. And because of the limitations in that particular bill, there's a provision that the Health Care Access Fund would backfill any needs of the MSHA fund so that it wouldn't fall on our small businesses. So in the fiscal note is based on current law, but we have a couple of moving parts, and I just would think that, you know, as Ways and Means and others move forward, I think it's contingent. So it's important to know that we have some moving parts that we're not quite sure how they're going to play out. The other one is, in conference, we have a proposal that would reject the early medical assistance that was just signed, authorized by the governor at the start of his term, and that if that goes into the final budget proposal, we'd have some people who are currently on MinnesotaCare that would potentially fall back onto this that have been on early MA. And so there's some wild cards. So I think it's I appreciate, Representative Dean, that you have, you know, put it contingent upon those things, because I think it's pretty sure that in 2014, with the Affordable Care Act, with the increasing federal funds that are going to be coming in, more people being eligible for premium subsidies, that with the federal health care reform, I think we have more confidence going on after the federal reform is fully implemented, that we won't need this backfill from our providers. But I just want to caution people that based on some policies that are being considered, the fund is pretty shaky right now. It will do better in the out years, and we just need to kind of watch this before, as we move forward.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And once again, this would only be in effect if the commissioners agreed that there was a 25% balance within the fund prospectively. But all of those issues that Representative Loeffler bring up are true and correct, and definitely want to keep the argument moving forward. And that'll be part of the discussion. That's why I thought it would be important that we move the bill along this term.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I just wanted to let people know there's a lot of moving parts in health care reform, and I think with the federal health care reform, this will work really nice for us in the out years. It's the near term years that we're at risk, and he's got it written as a contingent, so I appreciate that.
Virginia Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Dean. This is a regressive tax that would be great to get rid of, so I think I support your bill. I'm trying to understand, though. And I don't know who the fiscal analyst is for the health care committee. I know Ms. Templin and Ms. They're pointing over there.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, Representative Dean, maybe it's a question for the fiscal analyst for health and human services, but my recollection of the provider tax, and we've, Mr. Chair, received in our packet the fiscal note or the fiscal analysis for the health care access fund showing a zero. I had it here. Okay, here it is. Members have the zero, but my recollection on the provider tax is it was also doing a little bit of work in the general fund, and I don't see that accounted for here, and I'm just trying to understand the fiscal spreadsheet for this bill, because what I recalled is, and maybe your language, and you could direct me, Representative Dean, to where it is, what I recalled in the provider tax is there were a number of things going on in addition, you know, this is mostly it, but there were one-time transfers. There's a tax credit. There's some money for the U of M. There's some changes to the gross premiums tax. And the provider tax is funding all that as well. And so I understand how phasing it out makes the health care access fund, you know, no cost. But can someone explain all the other funds from the fiscal side for this bill? Because it's not in our packet. I mean, if it's in here, I missed it.
You'd come down and join us from fiscal staff?
Well,
or Representative Dean?
I can tell you that I can tell you that there is non-Minnesota care uses for the fund. All of those that I am aware of are within the HHS target. But there are non-Minnesota care uses for those dollars. And perhaps Mr. Walls can help me if there's funds carried outside of that, or if this would affect any interactions outside of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
Could you please state your name and who represents the record, please, to address the Lincheski question?
Mr. Chair, if I may.
President Lincheski.
Representative Kiffmeyer gave me hers, and Representative Crawford has it. So some people have it, and we have it. So maybe what I'm talking about now is if Mr. Walls can talk about this bottom piece there, and that was my concern, is how is that getting paid for then?
And please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Len Chesky. I am John Walls, House Fiscal Staff. If you do have a copy of the Health Care Access Fund that is to the February forecast, I believe that MMB is suggesting a technical correction to the bill that would basically make a small change to the bill and change it so that it referred to expenditures and transfers before any tax reduction would take place against a 25% balance. To your question about why does the fiscal note or the revenue estimate have a zero, if you have a copy of the February forecast balance, there is a projected deficit for the upcoming biennium of $230 million in fiscal 13. There's an additional in 14 begins to swing the other way where revenues exceed expenditures, and that's why you see the forecasted deficit dropping. When the estimates are done against current law, since there is a deficit in the fund throughout the four-year horizon of this upcoming biennium and the tails biennium, there would be no reduction, so that's showing zero for an impact.
Richard Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Dean, are you saying then on the spreadsheet here, on the University of Minnesota line or the provider and gross premium tax expansion line, are you continuing to fund that for eternity some other place? Or are you saying, I guess I'm still not clear what happens to the University of Minnesota line, or, and I don't even honestly know, Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Michael knows what the gross premium tax expansion is in the general fund. That's on the insurance companies. Or maybe, Mr. Chair, you do know, because you know a lot about how that tax works, but I guess I don't know how it plays in the provider tax being repealed.
Well, I'll defer to Mr. Michael. Or, Representative Dean, did you?
Well, I think that it would look prospectively at the expenditures within the fund. And as the health care expenditures would decrease, presumably it's written so that no other changes would be made, so that those expenditures would not be affected. The only thing that would be affected would be the balance in the fund, and what would trigger that would be something, projected balance of over 125% of expenditures. If these expenditures are within the projected expenditures of the fund, that would not affect the reduction.
Representative Lincheski.
I just wonder if Mr. Michael had any comment for us, if you were okay with that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, I don't know. I think the point that Mr. Walls was making is that the way the bill is written, it takes into account revenues and expenditures, but as you see from looking at this MMB spreadsheet from the February forecast, there's also this element of transfers out from the fund that reduce the resources that the fund has, and that sort of needs to be taken into account in the equation. At this point, the deficit is so large that I think it doesn't matter one way or another whether you do it, but in the long run, it probably does.
Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, I don't know, Representative Dean, you know, what, if I'm assuming you worked this out with Representative Holberg, I'm just trying to, you know, maybe it's a ways and means question when this bill goes there, but I was just trying to think of it holistically. Honestly, I know nothing about health care like you do. I've never served on that committee, but I know that, you know, the provider tax funds what's going on there, and so those bills always stop in taxes. But with these other tax items here, I don't know how it's all resolved, and Mr. Walls, I think, explained then that the language covers that, but I'm on ways and means too, so maybe we'll know more by the time it's there. So appreciate it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lincheski. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think we have to deal with the issue of the transfers, because I don't know how many of you looked at the Star Tribune on Sunday, but they did an article about how our medical school is actually losing some of its faculty because of the salary cuts that they've had to impose and the fact that they're on really shaky financial funding for a variety of reasons. But as you can see, there's $2 million a year that's transferred to the University of Minnesota that does support their medical school medical education program. And given, you know, what I read in Sunday's paper, I would expect that every dollar of that is precious to them in terms of meeting our need for a healthcare workforce for the future, because the projection is that we're going to have more people retire from the medical healthcare delivery system than we have people in the pipeline to be doctors and other specialists. And so that one I'm more familiar with. I'm not as familiar with the premium and gross premium tax expansion and why that would end in the projected next biennium. I don't know if that increases, if this is covering that tax for some people who otherwise would have paid it. I don't recall that one at all, and I'm wondering if Mr. Walser or Mr. Michaels or anyone else might be able to explain to us, because that's a pretty hefty chunk of dollars. I mean, the other thing would be to take the suggestion that Mr. Walls said he was getting from MMB, which is to include transfers until we understand, you know, whether or not we'd create some budget havoc without the transfers. I don't know.
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the provider and gross premium tax expansion line is a statutory transfer that I believe is in 16A. And I'm not sure if my explanation is correct, but I believe at one time when the premium and the gross premium and the provider tax was increased, it created a burden on the general fund because we were paying more in Medicaid money, and so but it got money put into it, or it created revenue for the healthcare access fund. So it was put in statute that some of that extra revenue would be transferred back to the general fund to sort of make the funds whole, or make the general fund whole, but still give the some increased revenue to the healthcare access fund. That is done in any year up to an amount of $48 million in any year where there is a significant enough balance to do so. Mm-hmm. And so you'll see in 2012 that amount, the forecast would be $34,490,000. If the legislature were to undertake anything that might create additional savings in the health care access fund in 2012, up to an amount of $40 million, that additional $13,510,000 would then go to the general fund before any accumulated balance would occur in the healthcare access fund. There is no transfer shown in the following years because there is no balance. And so any changes we make to the program that either increase revenue or decrease expenditures in order to bring that balance above zero, those dollars would first go to the general fund up to an amount of $48 million before they accumulate in the healthcare access fund.
Thank you, Mr. Walls. This is all starting to come back. We don't deal with this very often. And so I would assume, since this is the February forecast, the general fund forecast has already taken into account that these dollars won't be available in 13 and 14, 15. Is that correct?
Mr. Walls, Representative Loeffler, that's correct.
And thank you, Mr. Walls. Would it also be true that the university funding would have taken into account, would still be counting on these transfers because they're shown here, and so that would be showing on the higher education budget as well?
Mr. Walls?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that is a transfer that is in statute that is not contingent on any balance. So at this point, it is shown as something that would occur but is also adding to the accumulated deficit.
Representative Loeffler?
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just think that these need to be discussed in the Ways and Means Committee, where they put all these pieces together, just because I think it may have some consequences that we just need to understand.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And the motion is to go to Ways and Means. Is there any other discussion on House File 1584? Representative Lencheski? Well,
Mr. Chair, not to belabor this again, Representative Dean, not having served on that committee, but taxes is this committee. And I understood now how the transfers accounted for the gross premiums tax. But does anybody know, Representative Davids, you know a lot about this tax, but Mr. Michael, how did this get set up this way in the first place? What's the gross premiums tax doing in here?
Mr. Michael,
and why don't we just take it out? I'm just curious as to the history of what happened that someone stuck this in there. Somebody knows something.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the rationale for doing this, and I don't think it necessarily relates to the amount of premium taxes being paid by anything. I'm not sure. Maybe Mr. Walls is, but this was not a tax committee thing that I'm aware of or the rationale for.
Mr. Walz, why did we do this?
Mr. Chair, this predates me, but Representative Lincheski, if you look at the near the top of the Healthcare Access Fund balance document, under revenue, there's the 2% provider tax and 1% gross premium tax. These are the primary sources of revenue of the Healthcare Access Fund.
Person Lincheski?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And it's been there, but then you have this tax expansion issue going on with the gross premium tax. Maybe it's a tutorial for Mr. Michael some other time, but nonetheless, it's just sort of an odd, I don't know. I'm just curious.
Mr. Wallace, can you help us out here?
What, Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, the tax had been established, and those were funding the uses in the Healthcare Access Fund. At one point in time, if I'm explaining this correctly, there was a need to increase those taxes and provide more revenue for the Healthcare Access Fund and Minnesota Care. I believe that caused an increase in the cost of MA because we pay managed care organizations to provide MA, and that was a general fund cost. So we were making an increase in a revenue to the Healthcare Access Fund at a cost to the general fund, and so as a position to make it more palatable, this transfer was made to keep the general fund whole and not have a loss due to the expansion of Minnesota Care through a tax expansion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, you know, Mr. Chair, the limited tax credit as well, it's another curiosity to me. I don't know if that's that Section 125 that we're all trying to get rid of. Please, let's get rid of that. I don't know. Is that what that is, the limited tax credit? I mean, I hate to spend committee time on this, but the tax committee, now there's another line here with another tax item.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lincheski, that limited tax credit does refer to the Section 125 tax credit that was enacted a couple of sessions ago.
Representative Lincheski?
Mr. Chair, did you repeal that in your omnibus tax bill? I thought you did, didn't you? Wasn't that in there?
No, we didn't.
It's in the governor's proposal. Mr. Chair, you might be able to have a line of agreement with the governor.
You already got one of the iPhone tax. Okay, ringtones. I'm sorry. Okay, I will renew my motion that House File 1584 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Majority Leader Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for your time.
Item next, Representative Drazkowski. Oh, should we let Groffalo go?
You can go ahead and find ways to do that.
Okay, I think we're about wrapping up on testimony on the Drazkowski bill. Representative Drazkowski moves that House File 1598 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. Ways and Means Committee. Was there anyone else that wished to testify in favor of House File 1598 as amended? Anyone else who wish to testify that has concerns about House File 1598 as amended? Please join us here. And while Ms. Madden is joining us, members, please note in your packet there should be some, it's dated May 2nd, 2011, in the upper right-hand corner, moving various bills to property taxes and pulling one back to full tax committee so you can see what we did there. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify with concerns? I know we've got a lot of meetings going on simultaneously here. A gentleman up there. Anybody else? But I did say that we'd be opening up for questions of the author for members. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I'd like to express our opposition to House File 1598, which requires an extraordinary majority to approve tax increases. This is an unnecessary change to our state's constitution that could lead to gridlock, greater use of budget gimmicks, and a downgrading of the state's credit rating, which results in higher borrowing costs to the state. We want efficient and effective government that is responsive to changing economic conditions and the needs of citizens. This measure would limit options when flexibility is needed most. It would likely result in greater use of accounting gimmicks and one-time fixes to address our budget shortfalls. It would make it more difficult to repeal tax breaks that are found to be wasteful or ineffective. and it would make it more likely that the state would turn to other sources of revenue that are not impacted by the supermajority requirement, which could include fees, tuition, or gambling. Further, this measure removes majority rule and empowers a small number of legislators to block action. It would likely lead to gridlock rather than decisive action. This measure could also lead to higher borrowing costs for the state. Increasingly, credit rating agencies are finding that supermajority requirements impede flexibility to meet needs. Moody's recently downgraded Nevada's credit rating for imposing difficult restrictions on the state's ability to raise revenues to ensure that existing obligations were being met, and they raised similar concerns last year when downgrading Arizona's credit rating. And finally, this change to our Constitution is not needed to prevent tax increases. This body has clearly indicated your intent to address our current budget shortfall without raising taxes, and you did not need a constitutional amendment to persuade you to take that stand. Only a very small number of state tax increases have become law in Minnesota in the last 10 years. I think California serves as a powerful lesson in the dysfunction created by this kind of policy. Because the supermajority requirement fails to deliver on its promises, California teeters on the brink of default. And we've seen in California, as Representative Downey's questions earlier mentioned, there's more and more budget issues in California that end up on the ballot, leading policymakers to struggle with conflicting constitutional amendments passed by the voters. After the spring we've had, we probably envy the weather they have in California, but I don't think any of us envies their budget situations. And this proposal would be one step in that direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Any questions for Ms. Madden? Thank you very much for your testimony. The gentleman could join us. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Hunter. I'm the Secretary-Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, representing 300,000 members and over 1,100 affiliated unions across the state.
Sir, can you please spell your last name?
H-U-N-T-E-R.
H-U-N-T-E-R. Oh, Hunter. Okay.
My allergies don't always make a good enunciation of. Ms. Madden pretty much summed up a lot of our testimony. I do want to state for the record, though, that the Minnesota AFL-CIO opposes House File 1598. We feel that the first priority of this legislative session should be to help create jobs for the unemployed and to balance the budget. This proposal does neither. We don't feel that there's a problem in Minnesota that requires the actions taken by House File 1598 in recent time. The taxpayers have not seen significant increases in state taxes. And in fact, the Minnesota price of government has fallen since the mid-1990s. Now I can skip a bunch because that's been covered. I'd simply ask you to oppose this bill and resist any temptation to amend our Constitution until the constitutional mandate of a balanced budget has been fulfilled by the legislature and the governor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Any questions for Mr. Hunter? Thank you very much, sir. Okay, now questions for members. We have House File 1598 as amended before us. Any questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Drazkowski, I was kind of surprised by your comments earlier that you said kind of taxes are the first response and that this forces a serious look at expenditures. And, you know, I've only been here, I mean, three terms, and I'm starting my fourth, but I've never felt like taxes were the first response. I thought we always spent lots of time going through the expenditures and trying to reform them and looking at innovative ideas that have come from other places. And so, that was part of why the tax bill has almost always traditionally been the last bill, not necessarily this year, but traditionally been the last bill because people are doing everything they can to stretch and pinch pennies. And so I was surprised by that. But I was more concerned about sort of the practical implications and that we've hit situations where we've had tight budgets. It seems like we always have tight budgets, and that's an okay thing. But where the federal government has stepped up with additional funds for a purpose or another, I'm more familiar with the ones in Health and Human Services, in which the state has not been able to step up with the match to earn those federal dollars, which is really our taxpayers' dollars coming back to Minnesota, just like they would to all the other 49 states. And so oftentimes the response has been to allow counties who would otherwise pick up those service demands with all property taxes to step up with a match to earn the federal dollars. And so it's a lesser property tax contribution, but it's always seemed like a good deal when you get the federal government picking up 50% or more, and the counties have been glad to participate because of that, relieving that burden on the property tax base. And I'm not sure how this would really work in that circumstance, because they might have to raise some property taxes, but the match that's earned back from the federal government, for the value of that in terms of necessary and critical services, tends to exceed that. And I just didn't know if you'd thought about those kind of circumstances and how this would apply, how you're interpreting the language here, which is pretty general.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Loeffler, you know, I think like any other programs we look at in government, whether we are looking to the state taxpayers to put a match forward for a federal program that that the legislature is considering for the people of Minnesota, it's all going to be looked at as it has been in the priorities of the legislature and of the state. So I don't really see or understand there to be any differences between that and one that Minnesotans would fully fund, is, you know. So it's about us setting our priorities. And, you know, I don't know that you can deny the fact that putting a higher bar, if you will, for tax increases is going to bring the legislature to do a better job of scrutinizing its budget and its spending practices, as was outlined by Mr. Krinke, I think, very well this morning. So I think that's really the advantage of it. I think inherently the amendment would provide and bring from the citizens of Minnesota and instill discipline on the legislature to follow through and make sure they do their job in scrutinizing their budget to the largest extent possible, and also looking at redesigning and prioritizing.
Well, Mr. Chair, and our Madam Chair, and Representative Gruskowski, I understand that philosophical underpinning. I think we covered that fairly well this morning, but I'm just trying to be very practical. And if we have a county match, is that, and that, I mean, county's only sources of dollars are generally property taxes. I mean, that, for those kinds of things, is that, will that be interpreted as increasing a property tax rate or levy set or mandated under state law if we change a match ratio in order to get our share of federal dollars? I'm just trying to understand how you're interpreting and how we should interpret the languages in a real practical way. You know, whether you agree with the philosophy or not, how is this practically going to work on our committees? Or if an education committee has an opportunity to do some new things in special ed, we've always challenged the federal government to step up to full funding of what was perceived as a promised increased share of special education. And if we're in another deficit year, and the choice of the education committee was to ask school districts to contribute towards that match, does this kick in and you need a three-fifths majority of the legislature to be able to do that, or is that still within the jurisdiction of the education committee in the way that we would normally do it? And I'm just trying to understand the practical sort of, when does it kick in and when doesn't it?
Representative Gruskowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Loeffler, I guess I'd bring your attention to 1.15 and 1.16 of the bill. If a law, and I would, and maybe I could get some help from staff here, but if a law, and I would expect that would mean any law, increases property taxes if under 1.16 there it increases a property tax rate or levy set or mandated under state law. So if we are putting forward a law that requires local units of government to raise their property tax That would fall under the three-fifths provisions. That's how I understand it. Mr. Michael, I'd be interested in your take on that.
Mr. Michael?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I would agree basically with what Representative Drazkowski said. I think the key thing is, does the state law actually set the tax? You know, for example, it said, you know, if your local match were to say the local match is X rate or X levy amount or X per pupil or something like that, that would clearly require a three-fifths vote. If, however, it's discretionary and the law simply says you have to match this with local funds and it's up to you, the local government, to determine how to do that, then it would not be something where the state law is either setting or mandating that property tax rate. So I think the way to focus on it is either has under Clause 1, is the state law setting or requiring that property tax to be set, or alternatively under 2, is it raising a legal limit that constricts or limits the amount of the property tax? So, for example, if you lifted a levy limit or if you increased the levy limit, that is something that would require a three-fifths vote. But so long as it's still within the local discretion and you're not changing the legal limit on that or compelling the local government to impose it, then I don't think this language would come into play and it would take a simple majority to pass.
Madam Chair and Mr. Michael, but the examples I'm thinking of are where it's mandated services. So you can argue if you're a county or you're a school district that provides special education, which is a mandated service under the law, and direct an increased match in order to take advantage of federal funds or to stretch our budget or whatever reason, since it's a mandated service, you know, it's not written in the law like a levy, like some of the school district levies are actually outlined in very specific terms. In these mandated services, the county boards and the school boards really have no discretion. And so that's where I'm trying to get at this area where, you know, we have tremendous mandates, programmatic mandates, which are fiscal mandates because you must serve these people if they meet the eligibility requirements. And so if a policy or finance committee of the legislature changes some ratio related to match for a variety of reasons, which might include earning federal dollars, you know, does that require a supermajority? And, you know, you may or may not have, you know, people who don't serve on those committees who are particularly interested in those topics that want to learn, want to take a vote to increase property taxes in order to deal with, you know, a particular population of disabled people. And so I can see where you might have a hard time if we interpreted this to include those mandated services, getting three-fifths of the legislature to vote for that property tax increase for a mandated service where the match requirements were changed. And so I'm just trying to understand how this really works with our budgeting process. And do you have any clue on that, Mr. Michaels?
Mr. Michaels?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think, you know, essentially what you're Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I think, you know, essentially what you're saying is that as a practical matter, you would think that essentially the local government would have little choice but to raise property taxes, but I don't think in reading this language that it would fall within that, because of course they always have other choices of they have other revenue sources frequently, and also they can also reduce other spending. And the language of the law, basically the language of the proposed constitutional amendment, it ties it to what the state law does. And simply saying that you, in order to get a state match, you have to spend more money. Yes, when you have to spend, you have to get the money from someplace, but it doesn't, unless the law either lifts the legal limit on property taxes or either directly increases it or mandates it, I don't think it falls within that legal language.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think it would take some real thinking through of our budget process in our committees, because I think when we're dealing with mandated services, we don't typically write them in terms of property tax mandates, but we do have them as service mandates. And the ability for a school district to raise money, we know is challenging even with a voter-authorized referendum. For counties, it's very hard to raise money from the people you're served for. To qualify for those services have to be poor, or else they're in the correctional system and, you know, they don't have any resources either. And so, I mean, I'm just trying to think through if there are some unanticipated consequences that would have real ramifications for those mandated services on local governments, that we're the ones who impose the mandate. And we limit what their ability is to raise money. And so could we be creating some real conflicts between our mandates that you must serve these people, whether it's a kid in special ed or some other person who qualifies for a service, and the need for a three-fifths majority?
I think Ms. Dalton may have a comment on this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Michael is actually, I think he's correct that for most services, this wouldn't, you know, you could mandate increased spending on a service and that would not, at a local level, without leading to the supermajority. However, there could be some, again, this is how, depending on how you did levy limits, because, for instance, in our current levy limit law, we have a special levy for matches. And so if you are increasing matches, the way our current levy limit law is, you are increasing levy authority. And so then that would require a super mandate unless you also went in and changed the levy limit law. So, you know, it's not quite as black and white, and it may take more work to actually not require, to impose an additional mandate without needing the two-thirds. I think it could be done, but it's not as automatic, particularly if levy limits as they currently exist or have been proposed to be extended in House File 42 were in effect.
Madam Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Just one other note. I think Mr. Michael alluded to this, but members, built into the language here is the revenue neutrality piece, where if the legislature raises taxes one area but lowers them in a corresponding equal or greater amount, that does remain a 50 or 1/50% vote, majority vote. So that's part of Representative Loeffler. I mean, that's probably, I think, part of that practicality that we would see under some of those scenarios, I expect.
Thank you, Madam Representative Loeffler. Sharon, I just want to follow up with, and thank you, Representative Housky, with Ms. Dalton's comment, because if we chose to remove levy limits, because we believe in local control, and that's always been going back and forth. You know, we've had them and we've not had them. But if it was a choice to remove levy limits, that would take a three-fifths majority. Is that correct? Because it would authorize a governmental unit to impose or increase the property tax rate or levy without voter approval.
Ms. Dalton?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, if levy limits are in place when this constitutional amendment passes, yes, I believe that would be the case.
Representative
Walker. All right, thank you. I just think this will create some big complications potentially in our traditional ways of budgeting, and I think we should all spend time thinking about that.
Thank you. All right, I have Representative Markwart, Gottwald, and then Debke on the list. Representative Markwart.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And maybe before Ms. Dalton goes, I wasn't going to ask this, but I would like to ask this now. Ms. Dalton, if we have levy limits in place and they're based on levy plus aid, and if you were to cut local government aid, would seem to force up then the levy if it's levy plus aid, would 1598 apply to that situation, to the cut of local government aid if in fact you've got levy limits in place?
Madam Chair, Representative Markwart, if levy limits are in place under this amendment, cutting aids would probably require a 3/5 majority because the authority to levy is to levy back is automatically built into the levy limits right now as they are currently written.
Representative Markberg?
Well, thank you for that question. I have others. So thank you very much, Ms. Dalton. I guess I would like to know when House File 1598 would kick in. And so I'd like to use the current House Tax Omnibus Bill, House File 42. And let's say that House File 1598 was in place already. House File 42, according to the most recent nonpartisan analysis, says it would raise property taxes by $366 million in the next year. Would House File 42 have required a 3/5 approval?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Markwart, I guess I didn't see the property tax increases in House File 42.
Thank you. Well, it goes back to the fact that what the state does has an impact. And in the last 20-some years, the Microdata Group and others, being used by Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike, have accepted those numbers. So you're saying, Representative Drazkowski, that House File 42 would not come under the restrictions of 1598?
Madam Chair?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Markwart, that's my understanding. My understanding is that local government aid and its reduction would not necessarily mean that we are raising property taxes under the bill. That's what I understand. I'd be interested in Mr. Michael's take on that.
Well,
Representative Markwart?
Representative Drazkowski, I mean, I don't know if we have to ask Mr. Michael this one. I mean, I think what we're trying to do is put Fantasy Island into our Constitution by saying what we do as a state, you know, has no impact on property taxes in the language. On House File 1598 is going to ask voters, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to prevent the legislature from increasing state income, state sales, or property taxes? Well, I mean, to me, and we all know if you ask anyone nonpartisanly, what we do here impacts the property tax levies. Now, I think it does not apply under 1598, and I would strongly disagree with the presumptions made here. So let me ask you this one. The renter's credit in House File 42 is going from 19% down to 12% of rent that constitutes property taxes. That's going to be about a cut of about $94 million a year and will raise property taxes on those renters. Would that have forced House File 1598 to kick in?
Representative
Drazkowski. To cut the renter's credit.
Representative Markwart, my understanding is that it would not. Renter's credit is a subsidy to renters and versus a tax expenditure, and I think that's probably where you draw the difference.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. State law does call it a property tax refund and talks about the percent of rent that constitutes property tax. I mean, it's there, but I hear what you're saying. Well, let me give you one more, or at least one more. The House File 42 eliminates the market value homestead credit. And that will force up property taxes. Would that have forced 1598 to be kicked in, the elimination of the market value homestead credit?
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in staff's take on that, Representative Markwart.
Ms. Dalton? Or Mr. Michael? Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, I may actually defer to either Mr. Michael or Mr. Hines because it relates to an imposition or increase in a tax rate or a levy, and I'm not sure eliminating the market value homestead credit increases the rate or the well, it may actually increase the rate, but I guess I would rather hear from Mr. Hines on that.
We don't know where.
No, that's Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hines, you want to join us?
Mr. Chair, well, Mr. Hines is joining us. Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes, Representative Justowski.
Representative Markwart, you know, we may want to talk about these individually one at a time, but the tax cuts in the House tax bill are greater than any of these, so the revenue neutrality part of the bill would give us the ability with the majority vote to enact those. The beauty, by the way, Representative Markwart, of House File 1598.
Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski, the statistics I have that in 12 and 13, the income tax cuts in the House proposal, those are $221 million, and the total property tax increases, which you're not recognizing but are there according to nonpartisan, is $537 million. So it would not be offsetting in the next biennium for sure. So I disagree with that. But
Mr. Hines, to the Markwart question, please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Markwart, I guess I would tend to come down on the side of saying that that would not cause a property tax rate or levy increase because it's certainly not specifying anything about what the levy needs to be. Clearly, without the market value credit and the conversion of the tax reduction, the tax capacity that increases property tax rates in general, but it can be overcome by reducing their levies. So I would tend to think it doesn't imply it. If Mr. Michael had any different thoughts, I would certainly be interested in hearing him. But it's kind of an interesting one, I think.
Mr. Markwart?
And thank you, Mr. Hines. I think that's part of the problem with House File 1598. Representative Druskowski, do you represent West Albany Township in Wabasha County?
Representative Druskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markwart, yes, I do.
Representative Markwart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Druskowski, the tax rate for West Albany is 79.57. And I know some of your rationale for saying that what the state does not increase property taxes, saying that, you know, the city council or the county still has to levy. In this situation, because of the changes and the elimination of the market value homestead credit, without any change by the township board or the county board or the school district, that resident in West Albany Township who has a $75,000 home with a tax rate of 79.57 is going to pay overnight $62 more in property taxes without anything else happening. The reason why is that when you've got a house that is $75,000 market value, current law says that the market value homestead credit is going to be 0.04% of that value. That comes to $300. So that $300 is set regardless of what the tax rate is. When the bill is done, you minus $300, that's your tax. Well, when you eliminate the market value homestead credit and convert that to a tax capacity, your credit's going to be equal, and you can figure it out the other way, but it's going to be equal to the $300 because that's the tax capacity in the new plan is going to be equal to the market value homestead credit, but its tax capacity times tax rate is your tax. So when you've got roughly an 80% tax rate, instead of getting $300, times that by 80, it's $240. So my point here is that no local entity did anything, but the action by the legislature, House File 42, will raise taxes on those household owners by $62. Now, in some of my townships in Clay County, they're down to as low as 60%. which means if they have a $75,000 home, they're going to lose $120. Their taxes will increase $120 overnight. That's what was passed in House File 42, overnight, without anyone doing a single thing. And that's the problem with this bill, is that no entity had to make any change whatsoever. Just what you did will automatically force up property taxes in West Albany Township by that much. And so, to me, that is a big problem with this bill. But I do have some other questions. For example, when I go to the Price of Government report, I see that post-secondary tuition from 2003 fiscal year to 2011 went from $740 million to $1.5 billion. That's a $787 million of post-secondary tuition, which would be double. So would tuition be considered a tax and apply under House File 1598?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Markwart, I understand that it would not.
Representative Markwart?
You know, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm looking at the Price of Government report, and I see where property taxes went up a total of $3.3 $4 billion, 78% increase from fiscal year 03 to fiscal year 2011. Would one dime of that $3.3 $4 billion have come under the purview of House File 1598?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Dalton says yes.
Ms. Dalton?
I was going to ask him to repeat the question, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Markwart, levy limits have been in place for a number of those years, and so to the extent that levy limits were in place and any of those increases were due to aid cuts, which were also going on during that time period, they would have indeed required discipline.
Very good.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also looking at total state revenues. And from 2003 to 2011, they went from $13.7 billion to $17.4 billion, an increase of $3.7 billion, about 3.5% increase a year. Would any of those $3.7 billion of increase in state revenues, basically individual income, general sales, corporate income tax, gasoline tax, motor vehicle, and so forth, how much of that would have come under the purview of House File 1598? I would think probably the fuel tax, gas tax.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. Representative Markwart, I don't remember the years you said, but for those taxes where we adjusted the base or the rate, those would come under this, but those that were increases due to economic growth would not.
Representative Markwart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Or Mr. Chair. Well, you know, when I look at this, you know, I totaled up about $7 billion of tax increases. And that doesn't include the tuition, doesn't include all the extra fees that are charges for services for cities and so forth. And not too much of it actually would have come under this bill. I mean, they're really, you know, it's a solution looking for a problem, quite frankly, because I think, as a lot of people had mentioned earlier, that, you know, there is pressure to kind of, the last thing you do is to look for tax increases. And, you know, it doesn't look like there's much that protects the property taxpayer here. There really isn't. And, you know, as I look at 1598, it looks, again, you know, and it matches exactly what the philosophy of House File 42 was, and that is protect the wealthiest Minnesotans at the expense of senior citizens in the middle class. I mean, that's what I see here. And I guess one last thing is, do you agree with the fact that 41% of the legislators can impact fiscal and budget policy? I mean, philosophically, do you agree with that, that 41% of the legislators could basically set fiscal and budget policy.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Marquardt, under this bill, the legislature would have the ability to raise taxes in those areas that fall under the bill in situations where there was a 60% or more majority. And so, you know, if the plea had been made and the crisis was great enough and the rationale made sense to 60% or more of the legislature, you'd be able to overcome the bar set in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the time here. But I mean, this is an important bill, and you know, Representative Drazkowski, I think you and I and everyone around this table agree with the wisdom of our founding fathers. And when they put together the U.S. Constitution, I think most and people who, you know, we have the longest living Constitution in the world. And other than probably the provisions that dealt with slavery, I think most would agree that our constitutional founding fathers did a pretty good job. And they learned a lesson, because our first plan of government, the Articles of Confederation, which went into effect in 1781 and went on till the Constitution went into effect in 1789, did just what House File 1598 is proposing. It required a supermajority for any single bill that was approved. It took 9 of the 13 states. And, of course, the Articles, the Congress didn't even have the power to levy taxes. They couldn't even maintain a navy to protect ships from the pirates and so forth. So, and also it was hurting their economy. So many of our founders, like Madison and Washington and John Hancock, they got together and they said, you know, we've got to actually have a stronger national government. And those founding fathers consciously rejected the notion of a supermajority for regular business, like taxing or declaring war. The only time you really saw a supermajority, times like vetoes and treaties and overrides and amendments and so forth, is areas that dealt with the separation of powers or the systems of checks and balances. But everything else that was kind of normal legislation, they realized the problems that there was. And they made a conscious effort in, you know, 5 or 6 places they talk about taxing or raising revenue, and never once do they talk about a supermajority. And I want to just read one of our founding fathers, James Madison, Federalist number 58. And he was Federalist paper number 58. He was talking about actually kind of members in Congress, but in the last paragraph he talks about, because there's a number of people who were talking about supermajorities. And so here's what he said. I'd like to quote. It has been said that more than a majority ought to have been required for a quorum, and in particular cases, if not in all, more than a majority of quorum for a decision. These considerations are outweighed by the inconveniences in the opposite scale. In all cases where justice or the general good might require new laws to be passed or active measures to be pursued, the fundamental principle of free government, let me say that again, the fundamental principle of free government would be reversed. It would be no longer the majority that would rule. The power would be transferred to the minority. And were the defense of privilege limited to particular cases, an interested minority might take advantage of it to screen themselves from equitable sacrifices to the general welfare, or in particular emergencies, to extort unreasonable indulgences. So members, I'm going to vote with James Madison and George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Edmund Randolph and all of those people who were there, and reject the supermajority. I mean, we learned about that. And even, I think, Representative Downey, I don't know if he's here right now, but he had talked about today a part in the Minnesota Constitution that really talks about just regular majorities. And the only thing we really have a supermajority for is the debt service, which obligates long term. So I think we're talking about, you know, really two different things. So members, our founding fathers learn the lesson that these supermajorities is not the way to go. And as James Madison would argue in Federalist 58, it actually could hurt the fundamental principle of free government. Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Gottwald, Debke, Dabney, Runnemeck. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think any of us has any doubt how Madison or Marquardt would vote on this particular issue at this point. So, Representative Marquardt, I do appreciate it. You do a thorough job, I'll tell you that. Members, I just wanted to call us back to kind of the main underlying philosophy here, and I agree it's important to understand the details, and there is clearly interaction between state tax policy and local taxes. But you know, a couple of points that are real important to keep in mind, and I know this gets lost on the public from time to time. I know that from talking with my own constituents and hearing what they have to say about taxes and the whole idea of no new taxes and a cuts-only approach to budgeting and all these terms we throw around so loosely here at the legislature that actually have tremendous impact and are actually quite misleading in a lot of cases. Taxes, for example, as we all know, tend to be rates. They're not fixed dollar amounts. And for example, right now, our existing tax rates are driving a $3 billion projected increase in tax revenues for the coming biennium without doing anything to so sadly raise taxes. We are, in fact, raising tax revenues. But most people have the impression that there are no new taxes. That means we haven't increased any tax revenues for God knows how long. And that's simply not true. So the tax rates that we have in place as a matter of our policies here at the state level are in fact generating $3 billion in new revenue. So it's important to be very clear about those kinds of things. And then the assumption, and I know Representative Marquardt has his analysis sheets and so forth about impact on local property taxes. I served on a city council for 9 years, and local aids increase pressure. But they don't by themselves force you de facto to increase taxes. And so I think we need to be a little careful about that too. As I mentioned, I think the interaction is clear. But when you put on levy limits and reduce state aids, you're putting a squeeze on local governments. I agree with that, and you can agree or disagree with whether or not we should do that. But the state does not, by that action, force or by state law require an increase in those local property taxes. And that's also a very important point. And finally, on the supermajority, I don't know, Madison may have been wise or not. I think, you know, you can go back to our founding fathers and other presidents throughout time and find things that you really like about what they said and other things that you might not agree with completely. I think the concern at this point is when you look at the fact that we're raising $3 billion in additional revenue, it's hard to figure out how you justify tax rate increases. We keep talking about this in terms of the wealthy and the poor and all. You know, you got the top 20% paying over half of all taxes and over 75% of all income taxes, and you got the bottom 20% not paying anything and actually receiving millions in refundable credits. And so we play around with these numbers to use terms like fair taxes and so forth. Members, part of the idea behind this bill is to say we should really have extraordinary levels of agreement before we start raising rates and adding to the burden so we can continue growing state government at a pace that, frankly, is unsustainable. It's outstripping most people's income, most businesses' income growth. Representative Draskowski, I appreciate you bringing this forward because then I think this is a discussion we need to have about the ease with which we simply add to the pile and increase the status quo and increase state government. We have had double-digit increases in biennium to biennium spending in this state for God knows how long, for most of my lifetime. And I'm hearing from a lot of people that they're tired of seeing that happening. They want to see some restraint on the spending side so that we see some of that begin to moderate. And at that point, $3 billion, you know, a 9% increase in state revenues. for the coming biennium seems to be enough. So I appreciate exactly what this is attempting to do, and I think we can have this discussion statewide among voters and have them decide on an amendment. But this is a fiscal responsibility amendment, with all due respect to Madison and Markwart.
Representative Depke. Thank you. And Representative Descosti, I don't know if you want me to ask you or Mr. Michael, but I've got a couple of questions that are real questions that we're facing this session, and one of them has to do with property taxes. And I believe we heard in this committee that and passed that we are allowing the cities or capping the cities at a 2% levy limit this session and or this year. And I'm wondering if I can ask Mr. Michael, does that mean that is a statewide law that says that you can raise your property tax, you know, your levy in the cities by 2%, or is the fact that we're capping it at 2%, would that mean that the city would have to have a supermajority in order to enact that levy increase?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, this constitutional first point is this constitutional amendment only restricts actions by the legislature in enacting laws, so it would not affect an action of a city council by its own terms to require a supermajority by a city council or so forth. So just to make sure that everybody understands that. With regard to your initial question about whether imposing a restriction on a city's levy, for example, if it said, city levies may increase by no more than 2%, I would interpret this amendment as not applying to that, because under prior law or under current law, those levies were unrestricted, and this is imposing a restriction on the levy, not authorizing a higher levy or increasing a property tax rate that otherwise could be imposed. So enacting a levy limit or a levy restriction would not be subject to this, but once that's in place, if you wanted to repeal it, then you would have to have a supermajority, because then you are, in fact, authorizing a higher property tax by the local.
Yes, thank you. And I just have one other follow-up question. Also, in education finance this year, as it relates to special education funding, we are capping the special education funding for our school districts this year, and assuming that there will be no new enrollees, I think, in special education. However, if the school district needs to go out and chooses to go out for a levy to cover the cost that of federally mandated laws in regards to special education, will that need a supermajority as well?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Depke, if the change in the law would actually result, this is one of the instances that Pat was sort of alluding to when she testified before, if in connection with some mandated service, as part of that mandated service, your levy automatically goes up as that service changes or as aid is reduced, then absent qualifying it for an out under the revenue neutrality provision, I would think this amendment would require a supermajority. So to keep it very simple, let's say you have a special education formula that says for some number of pupils you can levy X dollars amount less your aid, and you cut the aid, then the levy increases and it would require supermajority. It would require the 3/5 vote approval. So if as a result of what you're doing that increases the permitted levy, then it would require the supermajority. Now on the other hand, because of the revenue neutrality provision, if some districts get an increase and others get a reduction, and overall it's no increase in levies, or it's like a zero levy target is often what's talked about in the Education Committee. If the bill is scored as a zero levy change, the fact that some districts go up and others go down so long as the total levy does not go up, then it would not require anything more than a simple majority approval.
Thank you. That's the end of my questions.
Okay, thank you, Representative Deputy, Representative Dabney, and Runbeck, Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. couple questions for the author. Actually, I was reading some religious history over the weekend, and I was intrigued. Poland in the 1500s, the nobility paid no taxes. I just thought that was stunning. Everybody else paid taxes. The nobility did not. It seemed just to resonate with modern, from Poland in the 1500s to Minnesota in the 21st century. It was kind of an odd moment there.
Are you suggesting that Drazkowski is nobility representative?
do I have to answer that?
Or is he suggesting I'm Polish?
Thank you.
I asked Drazkowski was nobility.
Members, please. Representative
Dabney. Representative Drazkowski, that was not directed specifically to you. It was just that I just was struck by that because it does seem to be the goal of the current nobility. You'd indicated this morning that part of your rationale for bringing forward the bill was to prohibit majorities from being legislative majorities from being able to raise taxes. And I'm wondering what else shouldn't legislative majorities be allowed to do?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, whatever the people tell them they can't do.
Representative Dabney?
But, Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm confused. If we can set aside the majority of Minnesotans voted for a gubernatorial candidate whose platform included raising taxes and having a balanced approach to the budget, if a majority of legislators are elected on a platform that includes doing something with taxes that would increase them, shouldn't the majority under what you just said, the people telling them to do this, be allowed to do that?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, we have, I haven't counted up the number of amendments in our state constitution, but...
Someone else has.
Someone else has. We've had well over 200 proposed since statehood, and obviously not all of those have passed, and all of those were brought forward ostensibly by a legislature proposed to the people, and the people provided guidance to the legislature in each and every one of those, and this is another one of those that is offered as a proposal to the people to provide another piece of guidance to the legislature in the way they work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I'm still not understanding an answer to my question. The question was, what else shouldn't, if tax policy shouldn't be decided by the majority of the legislature, what other policy should not be decided by a majority of the legislature?
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Mr. Chair, and Representative Dabney, the people have already laid out in our Constitution that it takes three-fifths of a vote in order for us to borrow money. It takes supermajorities to in the U.S. Congress to bring forward a constitutional amendment proposal to the states. It takes three-quarters of majority of the states in order to ratify those constitutional amendments. It takes 60% cloture in Congress in order to overcome the hurdle that is set in the rules of Congress. These are not items that are not heard of. As a matter of fact, it was outlined earlier, there are 17 states that have a variety of different amendments in their constitution, 16 actually, one is statutory, that have similar amendments in their constitution brought forward by the people in their states to provide the guidance and direction and limitations to their legislators.
Thank you, Mr. Drazkowski. I've never considered, or at least not in recent years, considered the United States Senate to be a model of efficient democratic governance, so I'm struck that you do, apparently. In fact, I'm dumbfounded. But you'd also indicated that government has to be accountable to the people. If a majority of the people vote for a majority of the legislature that wishes to carry out the majority of the people's wishes, and that includes new revenue in order to be able to fulfill those wishes, wouldn't your amendment prohibit the accountability of those legislators back to their voters?
Representative Drazkowski.
Well, Representative Davney, the legislators that come here operate within the confines of the Constitution to carry out the will of the people. And when we come here, we do that in a wide variety of areas. And my vision for this amendment, when and if it's placed on the ballot and passed by the people of Minnesota, is that it will be one more of those pieces of guidance that guide us. And as was mentioned earlier, would require a higher bar for us to raise taxes on the people and the businesses of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Reverend Drazkowski. I'm thinking particularly of K-12 education. This year's K-12 finance bill would have required a 3/5 majority because it raised property taxes. I checked in with nonpartisan staff, K-12 staff. They indicated that they can't think of a K-12 bill in the last 20 years that wouldn't have required a 3/5 majority vote in order to pass. So the majority of legislators responding to the majority of the voters wanting a certain policy direction in K-12, expanded funding of early childhood, something dealing with special education, as Representative Loeffler's touched on, any variety of other things would have required a 3/5 majority to accomplish. Was it in your intent that education policy also fall under a 3/5 majority vote requirement?
Representative Drazkowski.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Davney, any and all those things we talked about earlier that are included in the bill and prompted by the bill would fall under the 3/5 majority. And if it is a good idea and it is that necessary and the people are asking that much for a tax increase, the legislature with this particular provision in the Constitution, it would be your and my and other legislators' role at that point, if it reached those, and we believed it did, to follow through and figure out how to get a 60% vote, just like you and I and others operating under the rules of a majority vote work to get 50% plus one.
Mr. Chair, I'll give up as suggested. I'm just struck. It's been 119 days that this legislature has been in session, 2,856 hours, 171,360 minutes. I'm a little fuzzy on the exact. Not sure if that's from noon today or at midnight tonight. And we still haven't gotten a balanced budget out of the legislative majority. 119 days to do your first priority, reinforced by a number of members on the floor today. Representative Myra was one of the ones that was questioned by Representative Winkler. And instead of dealing with balancing the state budget, we're talking about thwarting the will of the majority of people who want a efficient government that responds to the needs of the majority of voters on any given election. I think, I oppose term limits because I think with an election every 2 years, there's your term limit. And if the voters don't want me there, they can take care of that in November of 2012. And they've had a number of opportunities in the past. Here, instead of resolving the state's real issues, you're putting roadblocks in front of the will of the majority for the future. I guess I'm joining Madison and Marquardt on respecting instead the will of the people of Minnesota on this one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davini, Representative Runbeck, and Lancheski. Representative Runbeck passes. Representative Lancheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask you, and it's maybe Mr. Michael, House Bill 42. The federal conformity provisions. Were there provisions in that bill that expanded a state tax base?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lancheski, I don't, House File 42 did federal conformity for tax year 10 only, and that passed separately. Yeah, House File 42 does not have any federal conformity in the House, and I forget.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I'm confusing them, but federal conformity then, whether it's 1 year or permanentized ultimately, which, Mr. Chair, you've said we're going to come back and still do federal conformity this year, and the clock's ticking, so we've got
to... I said we'd look at it.
Well, I'm looking forward to looking at it. But maybe Mr. Michael can tell us if the federal conformity provisions passed by the House would have failed the test of this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lincheski, the tax year 10 conformity only, I believe, did not increase taxes because it was 10 only. If you were to do permanent federal conformity, that would be a tax reduction under this, and so it would not violate this either. It wouldn't require a 3/5 vote to approve it.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we, you know, this is a chapter not yet decided, and Mr. Chair, you know, this committee and Representative Drazkowski serves on is going to have to deal with it. Still got those Bush-Obama tax cuts hanging out there, and if we don't go along, everyone's going to get an income tax increase in Minnesota. So that's, you know, an issue for another day, and it'll have a lot to do with your bill if it makes it on the ballot. But, you know, Mr. Chair, I think this whole process, talking about this constitutional amendment and to you, Representative Drazkowski, is really frustrating. Because I've supported a lot of constitutional amendments. I am not a legislator who thinks they're all bad or all good. I think we all reserve the right to think it through a little bit. I, listening to this morning and now, just trying to imagine how the voters are going to understand this when we don't understand it. We're all kind of trying to, does this work, does that work? So, you know, you're going to have to explain all these nuances to the voters, I guess, and maybe, you know, complication is easier, and then people don't understand it and don't know that they're voting against their schools or whatever, you know. But you know, I hope you will think long and hard about how you're going to construct this. I think California's been mentioned a couple times today, and California requires a supermajority for all their budget bills, you know. So that would be Representative Garofalo's bill and Representative, you know, every chair, your bill, everybody's bill, supermajority. That's what California does. And I think California is a mess. But what I would say is I think it's a more honest approach to not favor one side of the debate. So if we're going to have an extra hurdle to get over on one side of the ledger, let's have an extra hurdle to get over on the other side of the ledger. So, for example, why not have the things, you know, you can't cut per pupil funding without 3/5 of the vote. I mean, so you're always favoring, if this goes on, and I don't have any doubt that this will pass this committee tonight and pass the legislature and maybe even pass the voters, but it will always prefer one side of the argument, no matter who's in charge, no matter who the voters select. It will always give a super hand to the minority, no matter who that is, to limit the size of government. And I think that's consistent with, you know, your values as I know you. And so that makes sense to me that you're saying, you know, I'm going to do something that's, no matter who's in charge, Republicans or Democrats, will always make it harder for there to be revenue to buy government services. And I can respect that as a philosophy. I actually am kind of between the two on we should always fund, because I'm not a big fan of that, but we should never tax, you know, or make it very hard. You know, I think the middle is the approach would be to have both sides of the ledger, take a 3/5 majority, not prefer one side of the over the other. And I guess I just, you know, we're not going to convince you. I mean, that's clear to me. But I hope you'll think about this between Ways and Means, and as you work with your caucus and as you work with Governor Dayton, because there's a lot of work that has to get done here. And I think this is distracting everyone from solving the budget, but maybe that's intentional. Maybe it's to get Governor Dayton to pay attention to the things that the majority wants. I don't know. But, you know, I would just really ask you to think long and hard about this. When we were in the majority last time, we had not 54% of the legislature. We had well over 60% of the legislature, and never tried anything like this. And trust me, it isn't because we didn't think of it. It's not because we're slow, and we didn't know we could do it. We thought it was wrong. We thought it was putting voters not in the driver's seat like it's being said here, but tricking them to say, you know what, when you put someone in charge and give them democracy, they're not quite in charge. Because 41% of the legislature, no matter who it is actually in charge. And that's really, to me, and I'm not saying you're doing that, Representative Drazkowski, but that's the net effect of a provision like this. And the states that are doing it are trying to get out of it. Go study Colorado. Wow. That place is in deep trouble, and they are trying to pull out. But I hope you will really think long and hard about that, that not all of us are anti-constitutional amendments. And I think there's, you know, value in some and not others, but you're really not empowering, in my mind, this voter or that voter. You're empowering a minority of the legislature to always have to prefer the no tax side. And if that fits with your philosophy, I understand it, but I also don't think it's necessarily fair to give one side the winning, you know, get to be however many, you know, lengths out of the gates before the other side. And I don't think the voters would understand that that's what this constitutional amendment is doing. It will always empower the minority. The 8 years I spent in the minority under Speaker Swigum and Governor Pawlenty, had we had it not just on one side but both sides, well, we could have created a lot more chaos around here than the minority did. And I think the Senate analogy is something we should think about. That is just a nightmare. And as much as we all disagree on things, we generally like each other and we all get along, and we ultimately, end of the day, we usually get done on time. It's rare not to. Contrary to, you know, how things are reported, most of the time we adjourn on time. And the only special sessions really that happen around here are to deal with a flood and go home in a day. So it's a rare thing indeed when we don't get done on time. And yet we disagree philosophically. So, you know, I like Representative Marquardt, think this is, you know, we're looking to solve something that isn't out there. I think the electorate is on your side mostly right now. They are mostly not for spending. They are mostly not for tax increases. I don't think you need to, you know, give them another tool. I think this is true across the country. The rein in government spending is the message of the day, and it's one I agree with right now because things are not sustainable. But I really hope that you will reconsider how you're drafting this, what the intention is here, and to just remember that the majority in the last 4 years who had a super, super, super majority did not do this. And can you imagine now how you all, who don't have 60% of the legislature, you couldn't overturn any of that had we passed those items. Had we put in, you know, our side of the aisle's philosophy, you could not overturn it because you wouldn't have 60% of the legislature to do it. So, I think there are moments that they're rare in the legislature, but there are moments of conscience for legislators bipartisanly, and I hope everyone will really think about this one. This is not one to be taken lightly, and I know you will, Representative Drazkowski. I know you'll think about it, too. I just hope people think long and hard about what this means and what it'll mean when the majorities switch again. And it's just something Minnesota has not done in this regard, and I just really hope that you'll think about it, and I'm not asking you to answer any question. I just mean it very genuinely and sincerely. I think it's a pretty big deal, mm-hmm. and something people should not take lightly. So I appreciate you just listening to me on that, Representative Drazkowski.
Representative Garofalo?
Is the vote here? Am I going upstairs? What's up?
We're trying to get to your bill, too.
You have your bill still.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski renews his motion that House File 1598 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Drazkowski. We will recess briefly to the call of the chair. I'm looking at probably about let's come back at 8:30 and do the grapple. Recess. We'll call the meeting of the Tax Committee back to order. Members, we have one item left on our agenda. It's a Garofalo bill, House File 1303. Representative Garofalo moves that House File 1303 be recommended passed and sent to the Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources Committee. And members, that may seem like a odd motion, but the Commerce Committee's budget goes through that committee. So that's why we're moving it there to pass it.
Yeah, that's
Representative Groff, I'm going to ask a few questions here first. Is there, okay, you have a few folks like to testify on behalf of the bill, and Representative Groff, you can describe the bill. Is there anyone here that wishes to testify from the audience against House File 1303? Representative Groff, you know what that means?
That means be short and to the point.
Representative Groff, please describe the bill.
Mr. Chairman, this bill has, deals that the state involves a mutual. The state imposes a fee on mutual fund securities currently at 1/20th of 1 percentage point. This bill would phase this out beginning in fiscal year 14 to a 1/50th 1%, the following year at 1/100th of 1%, and slowly phase it out until fiscal year 2018 until it is at 1/280th of 1%. I have one testifier here to provide additional testimony if necessary, with regard to the imposition of a fee and what is currently allowed to be, what the fee amount is allowed for. Mr. Chairman, myself and the testifier stand for any questions from members of the committee.
Any questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, Representative Groffel renews his motion on House File 1303 be recommended passing into the Energy, Environment, Natural Resources Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Members, our next meeting is Wednesday morning. It's the regular time. That, members, thank you for your work today and every day. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.
I haven't seen anyone.